order, and we have a lot of business on our agenda today, and we have some bills we have to move through before 5 o'clock. Some of our members have to leave at 5 o'clock, so I would appreciate your indulgence. I know a lot of you have other things to do also. We'll try to get this done in, as expeditiously as possible. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 115. And you would give a quick overview of where we were when we left this bill last?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is the minor decoy OLCC bill. You have four sets of amendments at your place. I put out, put them all out again. The -A7 amendments are from the Restaurant Association. They have to do with allowing OLCC liquor agents to deliver directly to restaurants or places that sell alcohol by the drink. The -A8 amendments are conflict amendments, which we need to adopt since we conflict with House Bill 2892. The -A10 amendments are from Senator Lim, and they just further clarify some of the language in the bill. And there are -A12 amendments at your place as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Colleagues, we are in work session. I would appreciate a motion on the -A7 amendments.
Mr. Chair.
President Starr.
I move the -A7 amendments to Senate Bill 115.
Colleagues, the motion for us to move the -A7. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
sir. I move the -A12 amendment to Senate Bill 115A.
It is not the intention of the chair to proceed with the
A12. All right, fine. I retract my motion.
Thank you very much.
We're doing the we've got conflicting paperwork here for some reason.
Nathan.
Oh, yeah, the 8th and the
10th. All right. All right. Go ahead.
I move the -A8 to Senate Bill 115.
Colleagues, have a motion to move the -A8 to Senate Bill 115. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Senator Starr.
Move the -A10 amendment to Senate Bill 115.
Colleagues, have another motion to move the -A10 amendment to Senate Bill 115. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered, Mr. Starr.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 115 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion to move the bill as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. During discussion,
Chair,
Senator Beck.
I'm curious as to why we're not going forward with the A12.
After much discussion and a conversation with the sponsor of the bill in the Senate, the A12 do undo an agreement that was reached after much consideration in ways and means, and it does not allow the budget note that it would undo is a study and has many hoops to jump through before it would begin to impede upon the business of the grocers who brought the A12 amendment. And
was this amendment brought forward in the Senate or not? I mean, it's coming over here.
President Devlin.
Chairman, has the chair had a chance to discuss this or convey this for the performance of the bill?
Yes.
Chairman, all due fairness.
Further discussion on the bill?
You have to vote on the A12 if the opportunity were provided. I'd be happy to do that. And just, but I guess the chair is not interested in this concept.
Well, at this point, no, I think we should proceed and I have spoken with both the co-chairs in Ways and Means, and they have suggested that the agreement they reached on there was the agreement they would like to see stay in place for now.
Mr. Chairman, to the other members on the committee, and particularly those members from my own caucus, I think the outcome of offering the A12 amendment is known. If they were offered at this point, they probably would not be approved. Although there are people on this committee who would probably go forward. Mm-hmm.
Further discussion, colleagues?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Edwards. A couple of questions about the bill itself. Who specifically is this bill targeted to? Just the bill itself, the 116, who is it applying to?
Colleagues, You have the bill before you, Representative Edwards, that language in the original bill directs the OLCC to establish uniform standards and procedures for the minor decoy operations.
And are those followed?
Yes.
Does that have any impact on, I don't want to ask this question, like, does it only affect, are restaurants involved in this too? I guess, do they go out and inspect and put decoy operations in restaurants as well? Do we know that?
I don't have the answer to that.
And was there any, and one last thing, was there ever a discussion about the level, and you were talking about certain income levels, you had, I believe, $1 million, about what impact of what would happen if it went down to smaller stores that were targeted? And right now it's at $1 million, I believe. Down to,
I believe you're referring to the A12 amendment?
Yeah. I don't know if somebody in the audience can address that or proponents, but I guess I was curious to know why, whether or not restaurants were part of this to begin with, and if not, why not, in sort of these detail operations.
The A12 doesn't have anything to do with the decoy operations. It's in addition to the bill.
That was my understanding, Mr. Bear. I thought it did have some.
The bill, the 812s are targeted at basically, pardon me. Yes, allowing liquor stores to sell beer and wine. An agreement was reached in Ways and Means on the OLCC budget to allow a limited amount of sales of what they call boutique wines and beers to a limited number of liquor stores to try to do something to increase their profit margin as a way to find ways of making these businesses profitable. The OLCC, I spoke with Commissioner Ray Baum today, who's on that commission. They do not view the whole prospect of going down this road very favorably, but what the A12 amendments would do would prevent them from going down that road at all.
Thank you.
Further discussion? Please call the roll.
Okay.
I'm going to vote no today.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Evelyn.
Yes.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Carter.
Excuse.
Representative Piercy.
I'm going to vote no to leave open possibility. All right.
Would you please tell me, Mr. Chairman, which particular vote we're taking?
Mr. Max, we are voting Senate Bill 115 as amended to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
All right, thank you.
I'll vote no just to keep my options open here.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Representative Welch.
Aye.
Representative Wayne. Aye. Senator Henry. Aye. And since some reluctance on the committee, I'll carry the bill myself. So the work session is closed. The bill passes before the due pass recommendation. And we go on to House Bill 2989. Open work session on House Bill 2989.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Byer.
To get things started, I move the dash two amendments. That's the 2989.
There's a motion before us to move the dash two amendments to the House Bill 2989. That's another overview from our staff.
Go ahead, Mr. Putnam.
Mr. Chairman, you had testimony at the last meeting from several people. Tim Bruce Raleigh from the governor's office did not have written testimony at the time. He has since given that to the committee and I'll hand it out to the committee. The only difference I noticed between what's there and what she said is that they're italicized and not there, and I don't hear any italics in this record.
Any discussion on the motion or the bill, colleagues? Hearing none, will the clerk call the roll?
Representative Atkinson.
Aye.
Representative Beck.
No.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
No.
Representative Edwards.
No.
Representative Gardner.
Excuse.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Piercy.
No.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Representative Wells.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. And House Bill 2989 goes to the floor of the House. We'll do pass recommendations.
That was Senator Byer. That was a motion on the amendment.
The amendment, okay.
I would now move
on the bill.
I would now move the bill as amended to the floor of the do pass recommendation.
Okay, any discussion on the bill as amended, colleagues? Call the roll.
President Atkinson.
Aye.
President Beck.
We're on the
bill.
No.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
No.
Representative Edwards.
Nope.
Representative Gardner.
Excuse.
Representative Maddox.
Aye.
Representative
Piercy. Mr. Piercy, we're going to move on the bill before.
No.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Representative
Wells.
Aye.
Representative
Williams.
Aye.
Yeah. No.
Representative Simmons.
Aye.
And House Bill 89 goes before the House. They do pass recommendation. Yeah. I'd like to serve notice of intent as possible minority report. Okay. And Lieutenant Byer, would you like to be the carrier?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Lieutenant Byer will be the carrier of the majority report.
Representative Gardner.
Okay. We have notice of possible minority report on House Bill 2989. Senator Miller, are you here for SDR 23? Okay. We'll go right into SDR 23 then. And ask you to come up and open our public hearing on SDR 23.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, State Senator Randy Miller of District 13. Senate Joint Resolution 23 would...
Yeah,
those amendments to the Constitution relating to term limits. As you are all aware, we are currently limited in this process to 3 terms in the House, 2 terms in the Senate, a total of 12 years in a lifetime. Get your gold watch and see you later. I think there's a more enlightened way, and I think most people who are in this process understand that. And historically, Mr. Chairman, I actually offered a bill in 1991 that would prescribe exactly what Senate Joint Resolution 23 seeks to do, and that is impose term limits of 12 years, lifetime, but do not further impose the internal limits of 3 terms in the House, 2 terms in the Senate. It makes little sense, I think, in this process to make those additional restrictions and, I think, artificially limit some needed experience in both chambers. I think this is an issue that would benefit this process, would benefit our work product, would benefit the citizens of Oregon. I know there are detractors out there who will I guess, as I read it, made known a recent poll, which I think, frankly, was less than honest in its approach. Seemed to ask the question whether or not you would want to blow the lid off of term limits and allow people to serve 24 years as opposed to 12 years total. Of course, that gets a pretty positive response. I am also aware of other polling asked in a more straightforward, honest way that revealed that this is a tough issue. It's about a split among Oregonians. I am also aware of reasonable debate in the public. And if we can, I am confident that this could pass. Again, just a bit of history. In 1991, there didn't seem to be the interest in the chambers at that time to go forward. Perhaps there was a misunderstanding of the public's desire for term limits at all levels, particularly the federal level. But that was not done. And Mr. Chairman, just you all know the situation, but one of the things I would say about the term limits that are now imposed, irrespective of how long we go this particular session, the norm is about 6 months. And so when you impose a term limit of 3 terms on a House member, you are talking probably 18 to 20 months in a 6-year period of actual on-the-job in Salem service. And a lot of Oregonians perhaps are not as familiar with our process as those of you sitting up there and may not realize what a harsh restriction this is and how nonsensical it is. It is my view that if we are able to impart this information to Oregonians, they will support what is contained within Senate Joint Resolution 23. And I'm pleased to have the extremely capable representative from Portland, who is doing an admirable job on most issues, but on this one in particular. And glad to have Representative Edwards as a co-sponsor.
Was that a half, Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, that was
thank you. Mm-hmm. Devlin. Oh, Mr. Chairman, I'll hold off on that. I was just going to ask if you made that call, what were the areas where he wasn't doing such a good job?
We've got the freshman poly at 6.
There's not enough time.
I guess that's my cue to take off. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Senator, and thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randall Edwards, State Representative from House District 15. This is a bill that the Senator approached me early on in the session about being part of, which I think why I got onto it initially and still would like us to have this debate is what's really in the best interest of Oregonians. How can we best serve them in this body? I do believe term limits does and has created some problems for us, how we function. This is one solution to this. I'm also involved in another bill that we hope to get before this committee, which is annual sessions. And I know there may be some debate about whether they should both go out, maybe one over the other. And personally, I don't, at this point, really have a preference. I think maybe the combination might have some benefit. There is obviously some concern in this building about politics. Can we pass something? Whether this could fly. And I have drafted an amendment that I don't believe a good senator has seen for our consideration, which is the -3, which I guess is somewhat driven by concern I've always had with whether or not we refer this out, and that is because, remember, this was an initiative, is that the whole notion of self-serving and that argument, and again, maybe some polling can show that this amendment might help make this pass if we go this route. Which is in essence to say that anybody serving in this body today would not be able to gain any benefit from changing the term limits, nor would it allow anybody who has been termed out since the law has been enacted to be able to come back and take advantage of the law change. I guess I feel like perhaps if we get this to the voters that we should look at this as an opportunity to look into the future, not in the past, and those who are subject to term limits, I guess, and maybe the Senator have an opinion about this, obviously, but is we should make this as clean and simple as possible. There is no self-service, no self-serving, aspect of this, and therefore we should try to make, if we're going to go this route, to make it as clean and accessible as possible. Perhaps polling will show that before we make that ultimate decision about what we want to do between the two or both of them, what is the most likely to pass. But also, I guess I still want to come back to the fundamental question before us is what's in the best interest of Oregonians. I think as the senator described, term limits when it was passed, I believe, was more targeted at the federal level than it was at the legislative level here in Salem. And we had a lot of turnover. I'm not quite sure whether that was the intent of the carriers of the initiative, but my feeling is that it was more directed at Congress, which has had a harder time, I suppose, in seeing people leave than here. As was aptly described, we don't serve that many months actual service, time of service in the body here. So I think we do need to have a thorough discussion about this, and I would hope that we can bring an accession piece before us. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Whoever's chairing.
Yes.
Interesting testimony.
What? Blew him away. I just seen my minority club.
Any questions as to if I must disrupt the matter?
My first question with respect is how long is the witness list, so I'll know how many questions I should get away with asking.
You see him.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I'll only ask a couple if I may, Mr. Chairman. We've got these other alternatives. I understand the idea of saying, well, we'll limit it to future service, so we won't appear self-serving. But does that really matter to the voters? Aren't they just going to be looking at the essence of the issue anyway? And aren't we just kind of knocking out a group of people by doing it that way?
I guess that's starting to me since I offered that potential, yes. I suppose you can make that argument. But I think what I am concerned about is that is a potential Achilles heel. If we feel that term limits does need to be changed, we could look at this, I guess, as an aberration if we can get this passed. We unfortunately got elected during the time which we had it enacted. So I guess my sense is, and talking to some people, I think this might make this be more palatable. I guess I believe it takes the argument away from why we're offering it.
I would concur with the analysis of Representative Edwards on that, and indeed if this committee felt compelled to attach that amendment, which would have a direct impact on all of us, that'd be fine, because I believe in this process, and I believe this would improve our process. However, I think your point is a good one, that I think if we can have an honest discussion over the requirements of service here and what would improve our work product, I'm not afraid to tell them that some people who are currently in service would get to stay. I don't think that's necessarily a liability, and I am impressed by the opposition so far with their incredible distortion of the facts anyway. Then this would probably be lost anyway, in terms of whether or not they would express that it didn't happen to impact anybody currently serving.
Follow-up question for tonight. What about the alternative of just saying, look, we'll leave the bad term limits provisions as they are, but take away the lifetime provision and say that I realize I'm using a judgmental term when I say bad. I've always been opposed to term limits. But if we simply said, okay, we'll just ask the voters to approve a simple provision that says, you're out for 2 years. Once 2 years have passed, you get a fresh start. And don't worry about formulas. Don't worry about terms. Leave term limits alone in its current flawed fashion. But then say it's not lifetime. And just say to the voters, if this says the term limits knocks you out, but get revived after 2 years.
Well, as one who, I do not oppose term limits. Indeed, I authored a bill, as I told you, some years ago to impose term limits. It has been my experience that as admirable as many are who serve in this process, there is no one who couldn't be replaced. And I've served with some wonderful people, and as Representative Edwards has noted, the turnover rate itself before term limits, the turnover is something like 87% in a 12-year period anyway. So for the few who might be salvaged by getting rid of the lifetime going to consecutive years, I'm not sure it's worth the
the baggage it would carry in trying to promote this idea.
Representative Edwards, do you have a comment on that?
Not really. If there's one thing about term limits, I think, is, you know, it's easy for us in this building to maybe see the effects of it or maybe make an argument. I think once you get out of this building, we always, and I pick up on what the Senator talked about, which is we can be replaced and we do get replaced, and there are lots of other people who could and should serve. So I guess that's why I was interested in offering up something that I believe might help us address a potential political problem with any referral. Some have suggested perhaps we should let somebody else on the outside pick this up and run it as an initiative. But my suggestion is we should take a serious look at it this session. I guess there's always been the question, when do you do this? Do you do it this session? Do you wait longer? Personally, I don't think it makes any difference because we're as capable as anybody else to make this decision if we want to do it this way. But I think the question for me has always been term limits, annual sessions, how they might work together. Because I think annual sessions also offers you another way of helping address the process that has, I think, changed under term limits, and then the question of how best, if you're going to go with term limits, how best to change that, and who gets affected by it.
Thank you. Representative
Percy. Thank you, Chair. I certainly have never been a supporter of term limits and believe that it isn't serving this process that well. But on the other hand, I think to set out to try to change it, you ought to have some strong indication that there's a possibility that you can succeed. So I'd just like to hear from both of you what makes you think that the public is ready for this.
No question, Chairman Representative Kersey, I think it's still even at best and maybe slightly uphill. I think the reality is that the opposition will have a fair amount of money to try to destroy this idea. Our support will come mostly from editorialists for free. We've already had some of that editorial support come our way. It will be incumbent upon us to go out and try to explain it at all of the forums and so forth and just reason with the people of Oregon. I've been in touch with, and maybe I don't know whether you want to testify on it today, but one of the groups that was a very ardent sponsor of this idea, NFIB, is going to change its position on term limits and tells us that among their members now, the support for term limits generally has significantly declined. And so I think there is a changing attitude out there. There was a real fever pitch in 1993 mm-hmm. thereabouts, but there really hasn't been, to my knowledge, a lot of activity nationally on this issue anymore. And again, I think the target was at the federal level, and the Supreme Court knocked that out. I mean, those were the visible long-termers. My guess is, and you may know a lot better, that the longevity of people in state legislative seats is probably not nearly as great as it is federally.
That makes sense. The only other comment that I make about that is I know that we still public approval of legislators in general is fairly low, and so I'm not sure what kind of impetus there would be for people to be concerned about keeping us here. It's very hard to educate people enough to keep about this institution to be, unless you spend time up here, to really understand the effect and to suffer from it. And I just sort of remain in a quandary about whether this is the right time for this in terms of the public. I think it's the right time in terms of the policy. I think the policy has had a very bad effect, but I think it's going to be a very difficult. It could be a very difficult thing to educate the public about and get them to support.
Deborah.
Mr. Chairman, just a comment. The last time we had a similar hearing to this, I made some comments, I got a lot of calls after those comments. And it basically were this, and either Representative Miller or Representative Edwards has made similar comments to what we heard that day. But the comments we heard that day was that about all the expertise that we would lose, all the background that we would lose, what a loss it would be to the state. And the comment that I made that was basically that you know, there's 90 people in this building, 60 representatives and 30 senators, and there's 3 million people or more in this state. And I think there's at least 90, if not 20 times or 100 times that number of people out there that could do just as good a job, if not better than the 90 people that are in this building. The difficulty I have, I agree with actually all of the analysis that you've given much of it on the impact of term limits. But other than a few very interested people outside of this building, obviously inside this building you hear it almost on a daily basis, but other than just a few very interested people on the outside of this building, particularly officers and local League of Women Voters groups and others, I hear very little from the public. Very little concern about term limits or the impact of it. And what polls I have seen on term limits, other than the most recent one that was released in association with the proponents of term limits, say that the measure is very even. And typically when you take a measure to the ballot and you start out, you don't want to be even, you want to be well ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if, as adverse as people say that this is, and I do think that some of those things are reality, I wonder if we're premature and that the reality is if you take it to the voters now, the voters will turn it down and you won't revisit this issue for a fairly long period of time.
Well, I think that's a similar question that Representative Piercy raised, is the time. Is it too early? And I made a comment that I guess at some point, when is it a better time? I suppose you can keep doing polling and look the next 4, 5, 6 years and see when it's a better time. But you know, what is it that demonstrates that are the wheels going to come off? I mean, I think we know why we need it. I think you got to look at whether that's worth trying to make that fight and you can win it. Again, I've come back to the other option we have. I personally like this to have another. It was on the calendar today. It was pulled off. Is the issue of annual sessions, because I think that also addresses a process question, which I think term limits as it described right now, particularly on the House side, would help us get that experience level that is going to be basically taken out of this building. But I don't know. The timing issue to me, I don't think it's, quite frankly, if you're going to make a run at it, there's no, today is as good a time as any other time. I don't know how the case gets any better later.
The other thing I might add, Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, is that the polling that showed the support for term limits as was brought to us by the, U.S. term limits, they again misled people in thinking that we were not going to continue to impose term limits. We are. Senate Joint Resolution keeps a 12-year limit. What happened in 1992 was that the voters were offered one variety, one species of term limits, and it contained the internal limits that I think upon reflection are not beneficial to the state of Oregon. So all we are asking people to do is continue to impose limits on how long people can serve in this body. Continue to impose lifetime limits. But let's make the process more workable by allowing people to do the 12 years in either chamber, either the whole thing or the whole House, Senate, and make your best effort. Having the agreement and understanding, obviously, of the people within your district who punch your ticket every now and then if you ask them to. Or maybe they don't. You may limit it another way.
I'm probably the only member who actually campaigned in my voter's pamphlet statement for both changing term limits and going to annual sessions. Because I think that annual sessions term limits is the biggest source of most of our problems in this building today. And part of my reasoning was that I think we have an election coming up here that, because of the symbolic nature of it, being the turn of the millennium, gives us an opportunity to go out with some measures that really get at the process. And I was hopeful that we would have spent more time this session focusing on referrals to the people that focus on changing, revising, restructuring our process for a new century. And I still think if we really want to change term limits, I think now is as good a time as any. We just need to go out and advocate for it, make the case, be enthusiastic about it. If the body's not willing to go out and do that, work with other interest groups in the state that see the negative side of term limits, go raise the money and, you know, work on a rah-rah campaign on this symbolic election. If we aren't willing to do that, then we shouldn't. But I think if we do want to change the term limits, I think most of us see the negative impact of them, we ought to just go out and be bold and courageous about it. I disagree with Senator Miller a little bit in that I have a real problem with the lifetime ban. I think there are people that may want to serve for 6 or 8 years in the early part of their careers and for whatever reason decide to come back later in their careers. And I think if we really believe the concept of term limits has problems, I think we should also be bold about the lifetime ban regulation. And I have my term limits bill, Representative Edwards has mimicked in his amendment most of the bill that I introduced, with the exception of I've gotten rid of a lifetime ban that's reflected in the -1 amendments. And I have as well term limited all of us. Everybody who's in the system today would be term limited. I think that's a gesture we would have to make to the public. But we would be able, we in the process today or later in our lives, would be able to come back and serve at another time. I would be advocating for that kind of measure going out to the public, but I don't want to be doing it alone or with 6 of us or 10 of us. It really needs to be something that the whole body is going to be enthusiastic about, and the various interest groups that have partaken in this process. So that's sort of my 2 bits on the whole shebang.
Your colleagues, thank you, and thank you for coming and testifying before our committee on this issue today. I hope that we can find some direction and head off, and hopefully get it. I
appreciate your expeditious testimony.
You bet. Thank you. Close the public hearing on SGR 23. I know we have 2 of our esteemed senators and 2 of our esteemed justices here, and I'm going to be losing a member at 5 o'clock and have one more bill to do very quickly, I hope, Representative Terry. We'll get to it. It shouldn't take but a minute, I hope, and we will then get on to SJR 7. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2551, Representative Terry. Stuff, colleagues, there are -2 amendments before you. And Representative Sinceri, I want to give us an overview.
House members, Mr. Chair, HB 2551, the -2 amendments replace the original bill. It permits schools receiving state or federal funding to have military recruiting personnel on campus, and permits schools to allow students with interest to receive military scholarship training and or employment opportunities.
Chair, members of the committee, for your record, Glenn Sinceri, State Representative District 22. I'll try to make this quick. We lost this bill to the charter school process, and this bill already passed out of the House, had passed out of the Senate side of the committee with just a couple of minor changes. The amendments that you have reflect those changes that the Senate made. We did not want to lose this bill, seeing how it passed out with both Republican and Democrat votes on the House side. We had to give that bill up in order to get the charter school bill to the governor in a timely manner and be able to apply for federal funds. And so we utilized that bill because it had the right lending clause, and we're now trying to replace that with this bill. And I'm glad to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator Matt.
Ready for a work session?
Any questions for Representative Terry? Anyone else in the audience wishes to testify on the -2 amendments to House Bill 2551? And then we will close the public hearing, open a work session, and Representative Manning.
I move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2551.
Colleagues, you've heard the motion to move the -2 amendments to House Bill 2551. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll object to this. Representative Kearsey put it very well in saying deja vu. It's the same bill as Governor vetoed 2 years ago. This is the same thing that we've had through the House floor. This is all about Portland, and their decision, right, wrong, or indifferent, is their decision, and I'll be a no.
Okay. And do you want to comment on that, Mr. Manich?
I was going to ask something sincerely to Terry.
Yes.
I think you just read my mind, Mr. Chairman.
Actually, Mr. Chair, it's not exactly the same bill as it was last time, and the Senate has made some alterations, minor alterations, but I don't see any need to make further comment.
Okay.
Stay the committee's time.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Manich.
Can we simply incorporate by reference the floor debate on the original bill so we can save some time here?
I just wanted to show you, Mr. Chair, this is not a referral, is it?
No, it's not a referral.
Not yet.
Can you give me a idea? Five relief there. Yeah. Justice Edwards, well, in deference to my good colleague from Salem, I won't reiterate my opposition to this, which stands from its basement. Once again, an attack on public schools' right to make the decision.
Well, I appreciate your opinion on the bill, and would ask the clerk to please call the roll.
Representative Atkinson?
Where's Jason? No. Yeah. Okay. No.
Representative Carter. Aye. Representative Mendel. No. Representative Manning. Aye. Representative Carter. No. Representative Manning. Aye. Representative Carter. 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 Aye.
Aye. And House of 25. That's the dash the amendment. Recommend
that. They adopted?
If they're adopted.
I move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
He calls it a motion for us to move the bill as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Carter. Aye. Representative Mendel. Aye. Representative Carter. No. Representative Manning. Aye, aye, sir. Representative Carter. No way. Representative Starr. Aye. Representative Welch. Aye. Representative Hoyer. Aye. Representative Beck. Nope. Representative Aye.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to serve notice of intent for a possible minority report, as my colleague from Salem so ably points out. He has a knife for lady. So, Mr. Sinceri, would like to be the carrier? Okay, we'll send her to the Sinceri as the carrier, and the House of 2551 as amended goes before the House of Deputies recommendation. And the work session is closed, and we'll open a public hearing on SJR 7. Okay. Thank you very much for your patience, Senator Durfler and Senator Bryant.
Thank you, Chair Simmons, members of the committee. I'm going to be very brief because I have to take a conference call at 5 o'clock. Senator Durfler and I, I'm Neil Bryant. I'm a senator from Central Oregon, also an attorney who's practiced law in Oregon for about 26 years. As you review HDR 7, I ask you to not think in what the present day situation is as far as elected officials, but also think of the possibility of serving with Governor Sizemore, President Kate Brown, Speaker Kitty Piercy, and you can see that this bill is not intended to be partisan. The past history is that the Senate got into the confirmation business in 1978-79 when a dispute arose between Jason Bowe and the Democratic majority in the Senate and his Democratic governor, Bob Straub, where he pointed someone to a commission they didn't like, and he just said, well, serve anyway. And so they ran out and had a referral to the people about Senate confirmation, and it passed. John Powell was the lead senator on that and can tell you about the stories that led to it. But it did not include an amendment dealing with the appointment of judges to fill vacancies. And the reason was, according to Senator Lynn Hannon, is they decided to go with the Missouri plan, another option on that particular issue. That failed. Now, our bill initially began with Senate confirmation of judges. as you can see, the bill before you have it today is different. It talks about a commission that involves the Speaker of the House, the Senate, and the Supreme Court Chief Justice. But 10 states do confirmation by Senate. One state does confirmation by the entire legislature. And about 33 other states have some form of the Missouri plan or the modified Missouri plan. Current history on judicial appointments or vacancies is this, that once you're appointed, it creates more or less a de facto situation where you're there for life. We have that Ryan Smith do some research that I'm fumbling for now. But going back to 1981, when he found that there were 150 judicial vacancies filled by appointment, that 18 of those elections following appointment were contested, 132 were uncontested, and of the 18 contested, only two were defeated. So the point being that the appointment is very important because, as I refer to it as a de facto appointment for life, or unless the judge happens to get indicted or recalled, generally you are there. And it was Senator Durfler's and my position that the other branch of government, that being the legislature, somehow should be involved in this process, as is common in other states. Another thing to consider as you do this is there was an initiative proposed in 1997-98 that ended up stopped going after signatures. That was far more draconian than what we proposed. I would not support that initiative, but there is the risk that unless the legislature acts, something like that could happen again. I realize that we have the opposition of the judges and also the Oregon State Bar. Their reasons say we don't want to further politicize this process. Well, it's already political. It's just one person, politics, and that happens to be the governor's office, that you don't need to fix it because it ain't broke. Well, I think that for the scenarios that I gave you earlier, that it's only logical that our branch of government should be involved, that it'll create a heavy workload because there are two vacancies now in Multnomah County and 30 attorneys have shown interest in it. I think that's important, and I think people who would be appointed would take this very seriously. So I'd urge your serious consideration of this as far as the makeup of the commission and how it works. I'm flexible to listen to other ideas. What we propose might not be idealistic enough or the best process. I'd encourage the Oregon State Bar to come up with a different resolution if they think that there could be a better makeup of that commission. But I think it's time to consider that. And with that, I need to leave. The Senator Durfler will be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you very much, Senator Bryant, for coming today. Senator Durfler.
Yes, thank you, Chair. So I'm Gene Durfler, Senator from District 16, and Neil kind of covered the basis of why we thought this was an important bill. I think we all agree that there are three branches of government, the judiciary, the executive, and the legislative group. But I think that there's, at least from my viewpoint, a real weakness in that we have one person, the executive department, that now picks the judges. And that's the third leg of government, and there isn't any checks or balances on that appointment process. And I think what Senator Bryant said, that she considers the bipartisan because, and he pointed out, had in the last governor's election, had Mr. Sizemore won, and he's going to make the appointments, I think it would scare a lot of the people perhaps on the other side of the aisle. And I think the same thing that could happen, because there is an awful lot of power then placed in the governor at this point. Sure, they do a search, they do look at the names, but it's the governor who ultimately makes that decision. He's the one that makes that decision, or she, whoever might be there. And I personally just think that puts way too much power in one person's hand, because they really do then control the executive or the judicial branch of government. Because as Neil pointed out, of the 150 races, basically 132 of them have lifetime jobs. That's a pretty powerful appointment process that we have that is in the hands of one person. And I'm not criticizing our present governor or perhaps even some of the past governors, but I think that we could put ourselves in a position where we could have a real problem. So that's an easy way to correct it, I think. Okay.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Representative Edwards.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator, for bringing this. Because I think the balance of power is always an interesting one to try to juggle with the legislative branch. What's the precedent? I mean, you say other states have done this. What is that they've done this in the past a long time ago, or is this, or have they seen some trends that they want to change and hence we should be following them?
Well, I think, as Senator Bryant said, that I think there's 33 other states that already have a process, and there's 7 more that do it through just Senate confirmation. So it's pretty well widespread statewide. If you look at the national government, certainly the Senate confirms all of the federal judges, so it isn't something that isn't being used presently. But like I said, I think it really, I think we've opened ourselves up where we have a hole that could really turn on for us at some time in government.
Okay,
further
questions?
Yeah.
Okay. Mr.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Barr.
Thank you. Senator, I'm just curious to know, I mean, why, rather than this, didn't you choose just a Senate confirmation?
We had a constitutional problem. We didn't have the votes to pass it.
That's a good reason.
Yeah. I think that the confirmation would have been the best choice, but we didn't have the votes to do that.
All righty.
Okay. I did have one.
Representative Edwards,
just to get on the record, as far as appointments, what type of legislator are you looking for? Somebody who has a judicial background? Or?
Well, I think that would be up. I think it's appointed by the Speaker and the Senate President, and I would think that those people would pick people who have judicial experience or have law experience.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll now call Chief Justice Carson and Justice Michael Gillette.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Wally Person. I'm the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and I had intended to sit quietly back and let the heavy lifting be done by my colleague, Justice Gillette, which I will do, but this puts me in the zone of danger here for questions, if you have any. Justice Gillette is born in Seattle, but raised in Milton Freewater, and is the longest-serving appellate court judge. We have some trial court judges that have been before he came on by appointment in 1977. But he is our senior appellate court judge. He's been on the Supreme Court since February 1986. And I've asked him to come over here, and he volunteered. At any rate, he's here, and with your permission, Mr. Chairman, member of this committee, I'd like Justice Gillette to speak to SJR 7.
Absolutely. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Gillette, or as I would prefer, Mick Gillette. I'm the Senior Associate Justice on the Oregon Supreme Court, which simply means that I've been there longer than anybody else. Doesn't mean I'm the oldest. I should point out that today is the Chief Justice's birthday.
Yeah, bring that up.
And he is a good deal older than I. with respect to the heavy lifting part of it, this is a reference to my weight problem, but I will speak to him privately about that in the future. I appear here wearing two hats. The first is my own as someone experienced in the judicial business and someone who is a citizen who has a concern about the way we select and retain judges. I also have a note to add at the end with respect to the position that the judicial conference, the collection of judges as a whole, has taken. So let me do the first part first. A phrase that I first heard when I used to come over here as a representative of the state prosecutors was that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And that used to bother me because it never seemed to me that something had to be broken in order to be improved. And so that phrase always bothered me. But there was a phrase that I've always liked instead that I learned in the 50s when I was a kid, and I found it again for today. It's a Basuto statement. If a man does away with his traditional way of living and throws away his good customs, he'd better first make certain he has something of value to replace them. And the question here I submit with respect to Senator Durfler and Senator Bryant and others who support this measure is whether they have offered something of value. And I'm going to submit to you that they probably, while I know they intend to, that they have not managed to do that. At present, as you are aware, judicial selection in this state is carried out by a process in which when a vacancy occurs, either because you have created a new position or because someone has retired or died while in office, individuals indicate an interest, they are vetted by a process either through their local bar association if it's a local position, or they're vetted by the state bar if it's a statewide position. And then a list of names is submitted to the governor. The governor almost always selects someone from that list of names. The governor has little or no control over who's on the list, and the governors, by and large, tend not to try to. Senator Bryant says it's still a political process, and that's got to be true. That is to say, it has to be so that people who have an influence have the governor's ear, contact the governor, and say, you know, Fred or Jane or Bill or Louise would be a great choice, and I'm not going to pretend that isn't true because I suspect it's always been true. But that's not the same thing as saying that they have control over the list that the governor sees. And it's very interesting to see how often through the years governors have chosen members of the other party, or haven't even known what party the person belonged to when they were appointed. I had the honor of having that happen to me when I was appointed to the Court of Appeals. The governor first happened to be Governor Straub, called me and said, I'm going to appoint you. An hour later, his office called and said, by the way, what party do you belong to? Which I thought was sort of charming, if nothing else. And then I had the privilege later of being appointed by a Republican governor to the Supreme Court. And this is not an unusual experience. Justice Carson had exactly the same experience. He was appointed to the trial bench by Governor Straub and to the Supreme Court by Governor Attia. So governors have, in the main, picked people from the list that they were given, and the lists in general were created and vetted by a group that did not have an institutionalized political interest in the outcome of the recommendations they made. And governors have systematically selected people that didn't belong to their own political party. So the question becomes, recognizing that already that's the way we pick judges, and recognizing that there is no way that a person who serves in a judicial capacity can serve for very long without offending virtually everybody, recognizing that that is true, the question becomes whether there is some so vastly superior method of doing it that we ought to alter what it is we already do. Now, I will tell you, for example, that having had the privilege of serving for 22 years as an appellate judge on the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court, I know that I have written opinions, the content of which, or the outcome of which, have offended each and every one of you at one time or another. I also know that I have written opinions, the content of which, or the outcome of which, has pleased every one of you at one time or another. I can tell you honestly that in no case, I don't mean to be insulting, but in no case was I thinking about whether you'd be pleased individually what I wrote the opinion one way or the other. It's just not the way we work. In the first place, while you seek out problems and try to solve them, we only get stuck with problems when they come to us and there's no way to avoid them. So we're not proactively going out and looking for trouble. It just drops by. And secondly, once it does drop by, our job is to try to figure out what the law already is, whether it's constitutional or statutory, to identify the purpose behind it, whatever it is, and do our level best to apply that purpose, whatever it is, and however we may feel about it, to the problem in front of us. You can give me 1,000 examples, I dare say, where it seems to you that there was a significant intellectual slip between the way you perceive the purpose of the law and the outcome that one or another of us may have reached. And we could have cheerful and endless intellectual debates over whether you're correct or we are. But that's really not the point. The question is whether, by and large, the people who do this work are trying their level best, and whether the governors, by and large, have picked people who could do their level best and who have made every effort to do so. I submit to you that the record of this state in general is exemplary in that regard. I do not hold up the Chief Justice and myself as primary exhibits of that. I'll leave it to you to figure out whether we disprove the proposition, prove it, or have nothing to do with it. But nonetheless, you'd have a hard time, I think, selecting a group and saying these people just simply didn't represent that kind of history. Now, the thing of value that is proffered in place of the system that we use now is based upon the assumption that is based upon an assumption that I can't quite identify, except that, as Senator Durfler puts it, the governor simply has too much power. There are a lot of ways to limit a governor's power. One of them is, I suppose, Senate confirmation. The Senate confirmation makes sense in a situation in which the person once confirmed really will serve for life, and I assure you that every 6 years we have to gear up and run for election, and every 6 years there's a possibility we will have an opponent, and every 6 years a number of us do. And that makes all the difference. It's one thing to be sure that there is some political check on the governor when that's the only check that's going to be involved. But there is a profound check and balance on each one of us, and that's the ballot box every 6 years. And it's perfectly possible for any one of us to derail and not be returned if the public feels that we are not performing our job in a satisfactory way. I believe that. I think every judge who serves believes that. And there are enough judges who, there are enough former judges around to serve as exemplars of that proposition. Now, what is proffered is a suggestion that the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House should each appoint two people, and that the Chief Justice should appoint a fifth person. And those people should then supply the governor with a series of two lists from which the governor has to make an appointment. And Senator Bryant says, too, this can't be a partisan measure because imagine Governor Sizemore, Speaker Piercy, and I forget who the President of the Senate was.
President Brown.
President Brown. He says, so we don't care about how this worked out. We're not going to worry about it. I submit that the fact that it can politically gore everybody's ox ought not to make you indifferent to the fact that there's going to be a lot of ox blood around, and the ox blood is not necessary. The truth is that a far more broadly based group to create the same kind of list for the governor would create very little likelihood of ox blood. If there's a feeling that the legislature or representatives of the legislature should have an input, fine. Then perhaps the solution is to create a much more broadly based committee, which, by the way, has enough people to actually do the vetting job. And you've got 20 and 30 people applying for one position. It takes a lot of work to get through them. But create a broader based group and then go ahead and make recommendations to the governor, which even provide, if you wish, I'll leave it to Mr. Lazenby to argue otherwise, and even provide that the governor is bound by that list. The fact is that, by and large, where those things, where that kind of system has been adopted, it has proved very satisfactory. But this kind of system, I haven't been able to make a study of it in detail, but this kind of system, I don't believe exists anyplace. And at least I would be amazed if it existed very many places, and I think the indication it was even from Senator Bryant that only 11 states have the kind of legislative involvement, even arguably, that is being proposed here, and I think on close examination you'll discover that none do. Certainly very few. I'm also interested to know in how many of those states the judges who are selected thereafter have to stand for election periodic. I think the answer to that will be zero. At least there are states which use a modified Missouri plan. Well, I'm sort of bouncing around, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for that, but I know you've all been through a long day, and I don't want to keep you very much longer. I simply want to offer this as a suggestion. Whatever you finally decide to do, and particularly if you choose to submit to the people of this state a proposal now that has to do with judicial selection and retention, make it something of value. Make it something that 10 years or 15 years or 20 years from now you'd be able to look back on and say, you know, we did that and it represented an improvement in the way the third branch of government is selected and retained in this state. And if you can't be sure that's what you're doing, but you feel that there is weight to be given to Senator Durfer's point, particularly that perhaps the governor's power is a little greater than you would like, and you are confident, as Senator Durfer asserts, that none of your concern in that regard has anything to do with politics or partisanship, then I would submit that the way to go at this is to create an interim study, identify the very best way this is being done anywhere, and maybe make some small Oregon improvements on it. We tend to do that when we try that kind of thing out. And let's do something that the judiciary, the bar, and both parties can support, and even the governor could support, and submit it to the people 2 years from now. I know I would love to serve on such a commission because it's always an educational process to watch and examine how other people do the kind of thing we do and discover how many ways there are of looking at it and how many ways there are of improving it. Mr. Chairman, that's my statement with respect to the hat of just Mick Gillette, the judge. I can also inform you of wearing my second hat, which is reporting for the chief, that the Executive Committee of the Judicial Conference, a group of 11 judges who serve in an executive capacity with the chief is one of the 11, have considered both of the versions of SJR 7 that have been proposed so far, the Senate confirmation model and the present five-member commission model, and actually the broader commission model, and have opposed all of them. The executive committee would not, as I understand it, be opposed. In fact, it would probably be willing to have some of its members take part in an interim study. So that's both my hats, Mr. Chairman. I apologize this late in the day for taking as much time as I've taken.
Thank you so much for coming today. Questions from the committee? Representative Manning.
No, I won't say. Could you please repeat what you said? I did pick up the tail end. Your recommendation is an interim study to take a look at this. Would it be fair to say that the problem we have here really with this bill is that it institutionalizes something which really isn't officially institutionalized, that we have a system right now which assumes judges are elected, where the appointment process is sort of a backup for vacancies, but over time, because of retirements and resignations, we've had a heavy pattern of vacancies, therefore appointments. We've had traditionally bar involvement. None of that is de jure. That's a de facto part of the process. And if we're going to take a look at changing the system, that we ought to take a look at the entire system in a holistic way rather than just this one part of the process.
Representative Mannix, if I said it that succinctly, you'd still be out in the hall. But yes, sir, I think that's exactly correct.
It can also be described as a friendly leading question.
I recall doing the same thing for you once or twice when you've appeared before our court. I appreciate it. Although I wasn't always sure that was the way you saw it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you so much for coming today. I appreciate your input to this process. And we'll now call Gail Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Gail Meyer, and I'm a lawyer from Portland, and I practice with the law firm of Lerner & Meyer. I am also acting chair of a group of lawyers known as Oregonians for Justice. Oregonians for Justice formed 2 years ago in response to the initiatives that were being circulated then that would have radically changed the way in which we nominate and appoint judges to the bench. And Senator Bryant referred to those initiatives, and indeed, yes, they might be recirculated again. We don't know. But Oregonians for Justice resurrected for the purpose of looking at SJR 7. And while I am testifying before you today in my personal capacity, I want to share with you that as the acting chair for that group, I've talked with a broad-based number of lawyers representing all spectrums of the political persuasion and all areas of practice. And to the number, I've not found yet a lawyer that would suggest that SJR 7 is a valued improvement over the way in which things currently are. The coalition of lawyers that we deal with are defense lawyers from the main large business commercial litigation firms, plaintiff PI lawyers, criminal defense lawyers, family law lawyers, some of them even district attorneys. And again, to the date, most people have felt that SJR 7 in its current form is ill-considered and not thought through. There's definitely the concern that it would create a second political filter or screen through which these judicial candidates must hop through. But what I'd like to underscore for you today is the lack of local input and control that would be the result of the current model as suggested in SJR 7. Representative Edwards, you asked a question, I think, of Senator Dirtler that you asked it of. What was the precedent for this model of a commission? And I wanted to know the same thing. I called the American Judicature Society, which is a society that's national, it's nonpartisan, and it's not-for-profit. And it studies and it monitors judicial selection processes. I can tell you the following. There is no other state anywhere that has this model of a commission. When I spoke with them, they were alarmed to think that we would have one commission that would screen all judicial candidates for all vacancies on a statewide basis, both on the appellate level and the district court level. Most states that have a commission structure, either they only have a commission for the appellate court, or they have one commission for the appellate court, and they have a separate commission for each individual judicial district. That preserves the influence and the input of the local bar, the local community, and the local community members, and that in their view, was essential. If you would consider for a moment the work that would be required of these five members of the commission, you might ask yourself how they really effectively could improve upon the work that's currently being done for free by volunteer bar organizations. We could just take for a moment Multnomah County. Recently in Multnomah County, there were two vacancies. There were 32 candidates for those two vacancies. The Multnomah Bar Association's Judicial Screening Committee has 17 members on it. Those 17 members broke into five subcommittees. Each subcommittee had 3 to 4 members on it. They made sure that it was a balanced subcommittee of plaintiffs, defense lawyers, district attorneys, defense lawyers, etc. Those subcommittees acted as a group. Each subcommittee together interviewed the candidates. They split up, and between them, they each spent about 10 hours per candidate doing follow-up background investigation work. They interviewed not only the listed references that those candidates gave, but they interviewed the opponents of the cases that they had in the last 3 years, the judges, their former law partners, the associates in the law firms, and if there were any criticisms or problems in those interviews, they tracked it down with yet further interviews. So some candidates netted about 8 to 10 interviews, background check interviews, per candidate, and again, estimated about 10 hours of work per candidate. In talking with members of that committee, I was exploring with them how really could a 5-member commission replicate their work, replicate the thoroughness of their work. And here's just a few of their thoughts. One of them said, Gail, there are only 5 members of our committee. You couldn't get anyone to volunteer to do this work. It's too time intensive. As it is, with 17 members on that committee, it's widely regarded as the committee in the Multnomah Bar Association that requires the most work. And if you only had 5, they couldn't imagine how you could do it quickly. The other one said, you really wouldn't want to delegate this work to an investigative staff because, as someone put it, quote, you want to convince yourself before you act on it. And so before they wanted to act or vote and rate a candidate as highly qualified, most highly qualified, or not qualified, they wanted to have that hands-on sense that they knew what they were talking about, and they couldn't imagine relying on someone else to do the investigation. And as one of the members pointed out, because they were a local member of a local bar, they felt that they had the ability to go up to someone in that locale, a member of that same bar, and say, give me the dirty of what you know about this, because I promise you that this will remain confidential, and I will never, attribute anything you say to you. And they're not so sure that a 5-member commission, removed as it is from the locale, would get that sort of candor and honesty in the feedback and in the interview. So, and again, Representative Edwards, there's not any commission nationwide that actually delegates its task. And so there's no commission that has an investigative staff to go out and do these background interviews. The commissions are designed so that the commissioners themselves have the actual hands-on work. And so that is why they have an individual commission per individual judicial district, because otherwise the workload would just simply crush the commission in its current composition. The net effect of it is Oregon gets a whole lot of bang for $0 under the current system. There is a whole lot of work that's put in by these screening committees that exist in the 4 largest counties here in Oregon. I think that the counties that have these judicial screening committees are Multnomah County, Lane County, Marion County, and Washington County. Most of the lawyers that I talk to, they agree. A commission is not necessarily a bad idea. It might, in some form or fashion, be an improvement. But they don't think that SJR 7 in its form is an improvement or that it's a good idea. So we would agree. We would ask this committee to please slow down. Let us all do our homework. There may be a problem that can be identified with the current structure, although most lawyers think that the current structure works pretty well. We don't feel that we have that many political judges that hit the bench. But if it can be identified as a problem, then let's do our homework and consider what the numbers are and consider the time necessary to do a quality job to really see what would be an improvement. But it is our suggestion that SJR 7 is not an improvement and it should not be passed.
Thank you very much, Ms. Myers. I have a question. Couldn't the screening committees that do the work now under SJR 7 continue to do that work and make the recommendations instead of to the governor, make it to the commission?
Thank you, Representative. I asked the same question. And I suppose in theory, yes. The feedback I was getting, and this is, again, only from the Multnomah County Committee. I did not go interview the other lawyers on the other 3 counties that have a similar committee. Their thought was as follows. It takes so much work. They're willing to do that kind of work if they feel that their the results of their work will translate to something that will be really considered. So when they give to the governor a list of seven most highly qualified names, this governor at least picks from that list. And they're not convinced that you're going to get the volunteer effort, the willingness from the bar to do the volunteer work if they hand over the results of their labels to a commission that may or may not take the results of their work and employ it with the same sense of the quality with which they've put into it. So the concern is that you just simply would not get that many members of the bar interested in that kind of volunteerism if they felt that they would hand it over to a commission that may undo everything they've done.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, you alluded to it in your response, the governor isn't bound to picking somebody off the other side, isn't that
correct? Right, correct. But the governor is, he or she, politically accountable. And that's check and balance. I mean, if the governor is going to pick someone and place them on the bench that's not among the members of the most highly qualified that's been submitted to him by the list, then he or she's going to have to handle that and be politically accountable for it. But traditionally, they have remained within the list. And I would just like to emphasize to this committee again that the Judicial Screening Committee is carefully selected amongst people who are willing to serve on it. And it is very broad-ranged. You have a mixture of all areas of practice, and from that you can perhaps infer political persuasions. But it's not an entity that's only geared towards one particular form of candidate.
Any other questions? Representative Maddox?
Thank you. I just wanted to pick up on something you said a little earlier, that politicians here and as public officials were real sensitive to that. You mentioned, well, the lawyers seem to be happy with it, or the attorneys seem to be happy with it. You start hitting a caution point there, because I think sometimes we have a reaction to attorneys if you saw what happened on the House floor a couple of days ago. And my perception
would be... I'd up for you.
Yeah. I voted no on that bill, but we couldn't even get reconsideration, and I was trying to salvage it for Representative Shutterman. But anyway, what I'm coming around to is this. I think we need to be sensitive to perception here. And it sounds like this bill reflects the perception that the lawyers have too much input in the process. The reality is that even with a commission, the lawyers would have significant input in the process, but you've created a filter, another unelected filter, to the governor. And you probably heard my remarks when Justice Gillette was here. The caution that I would put out here is that if we talk too much about this as a lawyer's concern with SBR7, it makes it harder for those of us who think it's a bad idea to hold it off. To me, there ought to be a public concern about a bill which establishes, as a matter of constitutional provision, a filter process to the government. That makes me real nervous. We can revisit the whole question of why and how we do appointments in a holistic approach. But if you impose this, I say, secondary filter process in the sense that you have non-elected people who are participating in this, you're creating pressures that the governor has to follow their advice, and you could have a popularly elected governor who wants to move in other directions with some resistance then to revisiting things. So what I'm coming around to is I hope my friends in the bar will remember, too, that we ought to approach this from a variety of perspectives. It can be I'll call it the liberal perspective being concerned about the disruption of the courts, the conservative perspective being concerned about changing institutions willy-nilly in reaction to a non-existent ballot initiative and in reaction to several ones that that misfired a couple of years ago. And I would just encourage in the whole approach of this that we understand we are getting a lot of expertise at no charge right now and in an informal process that it's tended to work. But having said all that, would you agree that this interim study is a good idea to let us take a look at all of these issues at one time and try to get a better handle on where we want to go for the next century in terms of how we select our judges?
I do. I think it's much preferred over voting right now. And, you know, Representative, you've raised a good point. I didn't want to be misunderstood, and let me underscore. I'm not suggesting this is so great because the lawyers think it's so great. I'm suggesting right now the lawyers are really rolling up their sleeves and are doing a lot of this work right now on a broad-based process. And we're handing, you know, the governor is getting a list of names who have really, truly been thoroughly investigated, and I don't know that a commission, one statewide commission for all nominations and all current candidates on a statewide basis, could do that kind of a quality job. It's not an improvement. But I agree with you. I think that there are plenty of people out there who will say, and I talked to them too. I mean, a lot of them are opposed to SBR 7, but they'll say, I don't oppose the commission. You know, you're going to like the current situation only if you like the person who's in the governor's office, and perhaps we can improve upon this, but it needs to be a more broad-based coalition.
Thank you.
My only question when I listened to the discussion this afternoon is I'm trying to identify what the problem is that this is addressing and who's bringing it. I want to know other that if there's been complaints, if there's some indication that there's some bias in the kinds of recommendations that are coming forward. I want some kind of proof for that there is a problem that we're trying to address. I think we should always be trying to see if the process we have in place is working as fairly as possible, and so the study idea seems fine to me, but I feel like the piece that's missing here for me is the problem.
Representative, thank you. And you know, I think you're going to find the testimony of Fred Granham, who I believe is going to testify next, most elucidating. The lawyers that I've talked to, we really don't articulate a problem. Quite frankly, those of us who have practiced in other states that have had partisan elections or a more political process, we find Oregon very refreshing in its cleanliness. And so, no, there is no common complaint amongst the practicing lawyers that the current appointments are too political or too much of one political persuasion. We're all aware that the governor appoints persons to the bench of the opposite political party, and we think that's great. And the point is, it's like baseball. You want to show up and have an umpire that just calls it the way they see it, and we just want to preserve that part of integrity.
Chairman? We've got some other witnesses if we can move for some time.
Thank you
very much. Can I just throw one comment out on that point, though, and then I'll shut up?
Okay.
I just leave the room. That's the best way to do it. When we heard what's the problem here, I don't think there's a problem where judges are being attacked for what they do. But when the statistics show us that between 84% and 87% of all judges first get on the bench through appointment by the governor in a system that is putatively an election system, some of us think there is a problem there. There are other ways to solve that. You might have further encouragement for judges to finish their actual full term. You could prohibit the legislature from starting judgeships midterm, which we've done many times, so all of a sudden, and it's done usually for budgetary reasons, so that then the governor appoints someone to a half term and then the person runs as an incumbent. There are things this commission can look at to address those kinds of issues. So I just didn't want to be silent when I heard what's the problem here. The problem is probably less the quality of the judges and whether or not we have a de facto appointment process, and we can address that. But this isn't the solution either.
Just one point to make. The fact that there are not that many contested elections following an appointment could also be indicia that the appointment is a good process. That's a good selection process.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I zip my lip.
Thank you very much. Mr. Granham. And Mr. Lazenby, come up together. If we can be as brief as possible, we have three other bullets we'd like to get to this afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Chip Lazenby. I'm legal counsel to Governor John Pittcover, and there's been a lot of discussion about the process here. I probably know a lot more about it being a little closer to it than others. I have submitted some written comments to you. I just wanted to reflect on some of the material you've already heard, and I'll do that quite briefly. There have been discussions about the fact that 84% of the people that are elected, that are appointed, are appointed by the governor as opposed to by direct election. I echo what Ms. Meyer said, that probably is an indicia of the fact that the system is not broken at this point. In terms of political accountability, I think that there's a certain tendency, especially in this building, to become myopic, and I suppose I'm a victim of it as well, in thinking that accountability has to do between the various ends in the middle of this building. Many of these officials, especially the trial court judges, who the vast majority of the appointments that the governor makes, are very important local officials, and the people that have an oar in that are not only the local lawyers, but also the county commissioners and the mayors and the sheriffs and the chiefs of police, all of whom are consulted about the various lawyers around, and believe me, they're known. And although my experience is in the Portland metropolitan area as a lawyer for 15 years, one of the things that I have really learned in the context of working for Governor Kitzhaber as his legal counsel is the different nature of the legal profession in smaller communities where the judges really are vitally critical people. And I think one of the problems with the amended bill that's before you is that effectively is going to really limit and end and perhaps filter, as Representative Mannix was saying, that kind of local input and control. There have been appointments that the governor has made in the 4 years that I've been here. When you look in the bar book and you see who the eligible lawyers are, there is a list of 17 lawyers, and three of them are judges. So those folks have a pretty good idea of who the good and eligible local folks are, and it really becomes a question of who's going to gel and work better with the local political infrastructure that exists. So that is a type of political accountability that isn't necessarily as visible as we often have in this building, or the kind of visible political accountability that you may encounter in your individual district. When there are opportunities for election, I can only talk to you about what Governor Kitzhaber has done. I know of three circumstances in which there was a vacancy, and it became clear to us that they were going to be contested. Last year, 1998, in Washington County, in Linn County, I think the year before that, and in one other instance where we knew that there were going to be contested judicial appointments, the governor refrained from making an appointment, although he was constitutionally and statutorily authorized to do so that the voters could make a decision. I think that it is also important for the committee to understand that once the governor makes an appointment, those judicial appointees appear at the next general election, so there's a very quick accountability in terms of these appointees facing the voters. And I think one of the failings of the original SJR 7 and of this amended version that is before you is that it inserts another filter between the people and the appointments that the governor is making for these local officials. And I understand as well, final point, the concern about lawyers picking lawyers and this being some sort of in-house deal, and that the general public really isn't involved in that selection. I think what I've said about the elements of the process so far and the way people have input into it and the way the governor heeds what information comes from local communities is only a part of it. But let's be honest about this. This is a specialized job. This is a job that requires training, expertise, and experience. And in many instances, what we are involved in is a type of professional peer review that was described by Ms. Meyer, both for trial court judges and also for appellate court judges. And the judgments that need to be made about who's best qualified to fill those positions are best made by lawyers who come from all political, philosophical, and professional stripes. Lawyers are a gossipy bunch. We talk about one another. We have a pretty good appraisal of what the various strengths and weaknesses of our fellow practitioners are. And that is also an important part of the mix of the information that we get in terms of people's qualification to go on the bench. I'd be happy to answer any questions that people might have here about the way the process works. I think my comments both in the Senate and in the House indicate the concern, the deep concern that the governor has about the politicization of sub-judges and what the danger that can do towards maintaining an independent judiciary in Oregon, which is really important that one of the branches of the government be above the political fray that I think we've all experienced at some point in our lifetime, if not recently. So I'm here to answer any questions that anybody might have. In
I'll be brief. I don't know. I can't seem to let this go because it keeps being mentioned. I mean, we got to be honest here. The judicial branch has its own politics, and it's as political in its own way as executive or legislative branch. So, I mean, I think the founding fathers, when they put the three branches together, I don't think they were saying that one branch was completely nothing apolitical. So I've always been this notion that I'm not criticizing a comment per se, other than to say, yes, by having the executive department, who's an elected official,
appointing, ultimately you got the decision. That's a political process. You're politically elected, not you, but your boss. So I don't know. I guess I'm a little fearful. We always try to be so sure that the judicial branch of the third leg of the government here is apolitical. It's not. There's people that make political judgments, or they have political feelings, and you know, the law is an interpretation. I don't know. It's just like I had to get that out because it seems like we are trying to say, well, there is no, and this is. I'm not advocating for this solution. It may, quote unquote, be more politicized, but by saying that there is no political, that the system isn't political today is not accurate, in my opinion.
If I may, Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think the part of your comments that were accurate is that the politics of the judiciary are a different kind of politics. I think if you and I and four other people were sitting on a sofa and there was one TV clicker, the decision about what to watch would be a political decision and would be made in a political manner.
We're going to have a bill before us to watch Ultimate Wrestling here.
That's
so.
Right, Ultimate Wrestling is coming up. Although I think that anybody that testifies on that bill should have to wear spandex, I think, in order to really do that. But I think it's a different kind of politics, and I think in my remarks, both in front of the Senate and here, you can see that the danger is that the legal decisions that judges make, as Justice Gillette pointed out, he has written decisions that he knows has angered each and every one of you. He also has written decisions that have pleased each and every one of you over the course of the year. But he's done that on the basis of his honest professional view of the way the Constitution and the laws read. This sort of mechanism moves us into a situation where the judge becomes more of a political animal in the traditional sense. And now we'll look at cases in terms of what does this mean for me at the next election? That's a terrible road, I think, that nobody wants to go down, and I'll echo the sentiments of people here. There are a variety of different ways of doing this, and I think that the key lays in what Justice Gillette said. If you're going to change the system that has worked very well for a great number of years, if you're going to replace it, make sure that it's something that fits in with what Oregon is all about. This bill is not it. I agree with Representative Mandis. This bill is not it, and we don't even have a sense of the way in which the process could be changed that would be more beneficial.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Good afternoon. I recognize the time of day. I'll be very brief. My name is Fred Granham. I'm a resident of Washington County. I was a classmate of Mr. Mannix at the University of Virginia, graduated in 1974.
Oh, wow.
I'm a member of the Oregon State Bar and have been for a number of years, and I'm one of those lawyers that appear daily in the trial courts and appellate courts across the state. I'm a member of the firm of Bullivant House Bailey, and I should, as a preface, note that my comments here are my personal comments and not necessarily reflective of all of the members of my firm, because we are a large firm and have offices across the West Coast, and I'm sure there's a various different views about this very serious situation. In the day-to-day practice in the courts in Oregon, it's a privilege to appear in any court in any county in this state. And as this legislative body considers Senate Resolution Number 7, it's starting to tinker with a very serious system, a system which has grave consequences across this state. There's a great deal of attention, just as there's attention to this issue on the term limits issue earlier this afternoon. There could be nothing more dramatic, in my mind, certainly in the practice and the clients and the people that I deal with on a day-to-day basis, if the judicial system, the means by which judges are nominated in this state is tinkered with in a fashion that does not preserve the valuable independence which our judicial system has today. Through my practice, through my partners and other members of my law firm, we appear across the state on a daily basis. I venture to say our firm has a very active trial practice, appears in more counties on a daily basis than any other law firm within the state. We also have the privilege and the opportunity to appear in other courts across the West Coast. And it is a consistent basis that things get done quickest and best in Oregon. You can get a lawsuit filed and you can get a resolution and you can get to trial in Oregon, where in California, you're talking years, Oregon, you're talking months. That is a benefit not just for the legal profession, and the concern that Representative Mannix underscored about, is this just for lawyers? This is an issue for the population at large. But the Oregon judicial system works, and it works very well. Matters come to trial. There is a resolution. They go to the appellate courts, the Court of Appeals, and to the Supreme Court. There is a resolution. There's an answer. Now, I'm not here saying it's because the governor gets to appoint them, and it's tantamount to a lifetime appointment. I'm here to say that as you tinker with this system, as you look at this, I advise this body to do so with great deliberation, because it's a very good system that's out there. It's a system that you're not hearing a lot of complaints about. It's a system that should be modified. If it can be improved, the legal bar, I personally would embrace that. I think a Missouri plan and other types of plans for the appointment of judges should be considered. I think that is a lofty objective and something that, by the heritage of Oregon, we go out and we look for new opportunities, ways to improve things, and it can be done. But I am here to tell you that this resolution does not get there. It has not had the deliberation and the review by those that will need to live with it. In fact, the resolution that's before this committee is the stepchild of the original resolution. As was recognized earlier by the two senators that had appeared, this was not their preference. This was an afterthought. This just came along later. Members of this committee, embrace that point. This is an afterthought of an initial idea. It has not been reviewed by the Oregon State Bar. It has not been reviewed by any independent organization. And the testimony you've heard indicates that there is no other state in this country that has such a means for appointing a judge. Now, that doesn't mean that the fine folks of Oregon can't come up with a great way of doing it. In years past, the bottle bill. There never had been a bottle bill before, and we came up with a great scenario, and that's been adopted, and it's a hallmark of the political process for Oregon. But I dare say, tinkering with the ways that judges are appointed on a very fast, a very expedited process, without any deliberation, without any study, is a turn that this body should not take. Conclusion, I would invite you to underscore the fact, as the justices indicated and Dale Meyer's testimony underscored, is the local control. That is a very crucial issue, that wherever you appear, whatever judges are appointed in this state, have done so by local input. And there's no assurances that this commission, as is proposed in SJR 7, would assure that there is that local input. Thank you very much.
Questions in the committee? Thank you
very much.
Okay, that concludes the we'll find out the public hearing on SJR 7. We'll close the public hearing and open a public hearing on SJR 39. And I believe we've got Bob Santine. And
Thank
you. Well, we want to be Bob Cantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Cantine with the Association of Oregon Counties. To talk to you just briefly about SJR 39 and SB 1311, which is the companion bill that provides the ballot measure. This deals with HJR 85 that was passed in the 95 session, became ballot measure 30, and then was approved in the November 1996 general election. It had a very unique provision there. It's the first time in the Constitution they ever had a sunset. And this bill happened to have a sunset in it. It required after 4 years, in effect, that it be voted on again. And it absent approval, it was repealed. There's a Section 15A which repeals Measure 30 unless it is approved at an election in November of 2000. So the question that was before the Legislative Council on this issue was the first time to have to deal with a sunset, and how do you do that? How do you write a ballot measure that relates to a sunset in the Constitution? And they initially drafted as repeal of Section 15, which is the substantive body of the ballot measure. And then we had further discussions, and the more they looked at it, they agreed that it had its own repealer in it. Section 15A was the repealer. It repealed the measure unless it was approved again. And so what needed to be done was to repeal that and to retain the body of the measure. That's the issue that needs to be put before the public. And so that is the way in which the there was an amendment drafted to the initial joint resolution. And it is the one that you see before you now. Now, I guess basically the only other comment I would have is that it's something that the Constitution requires the legislature to put on the ballot. We thought it was going to be automatic. And then right at the beginning of this session, Secretary of State and Legislative Council, and I guess maybe the governor's office, I'm not sure if they were involved, had a discussion, said, no, you need to have a bill. You need to do it by an act of the legislature. So this bill was put together and drafted, and the companion ballot measure is there, too. And I'd be glad to, I know you're late, and so I'm not going to say much else. I have some information there about, if you're curious about how is it working, and I've put a few notes there for you about how it's working, but I would be glad to answer any questions if you have.
Questions from the committee? Ms. Christie.
Just a quick question. How has this, you think this has changed things significantly from before ballot measure 30? I know you, the whole purpose was that you thought that the public thought there were too many mandates coming down that weren't being paid for. But, I just found some indication of how you think things have changed since prior to it being there.
Mr. Chair and Representative Piercy, a couple of things. One, the governor's office has been very cooperative in trying to implement this. And they've been very clear with the agencies as the legislature develops that here's what the Measure 30 mandate is, here's the implication of that. And so before they come forward with something like that, at least they know about that, and that discussion gets held there. And I think we've seen very few agency mandates come forward in agency legislation, which is a change for us. The second piece is more of a, you shift the discussion to more of a partnership, and you look at things like juvenile crime prevention legislation, you look at Senate Bill 1145, those were fashioned out of not that I can tell you to do it, but that let's come together and try and work something out, and that's been a very big change for us.
Mr. Chair, could add to Mr. Cantine's response there. Mike McCarthy, Sherman County Judge, President of the Association of Counties. So, Mr. Chair, Representative Kersey, I think another thing that's changed that makes this more significant to continue is the circumstance of local government property tax reductions, property tax limitations. This is a much more high-stakes issue now, that, given the circumstance we're in, than when we first announced.
Okay.
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Lynn McNamara from the League of Oregon Cities. I just want to echo Mr. Cantine's comments, particularly about the partnership that we think has developed between the state and local governments as a result of this. The city see it, and we would like to see it continue.
Okay. Questions from the committee? Generally, you have somebody from special districts here, too, when we have something that affects local government. Are they okay with this?
Yeah, I don't think they did not appear in the Senate side either. I think they just okay, and if we were okay, they were okay.
Okay. Mr. Hansel, is this okay with you? Okay, let's close the public hearing and open a work session on SBR 39.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Stark.
Colleagues
have a motion to move SBR 39 before the BPAS recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Byer?
Just a little bit. I'm just curious to know if anybody knows the history of why a sunset was put on a constitutional amendment. I've never heard of that before.
Mr. Cantine, do you have some insight on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer. I think the state in agreeing to sort of share its power or devolve some of its power was wary. And it happened in the Senate, was where the sunset was at. And that was to say, this is something new. We're not sure if we like it, how it's going to work, but we're going to let you try it.
You've got to watch these local government people.
Yeah.
Representative Beck, for the record, there is a sunset provision in the Measure 66 measure.
Oh, it's 15 years?
15 years.
Yes, sir. The second one.
Much to my disappointment of hearing.
I did it.
Any further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Beck. Aye. Representative Byers. Aye. Representative Byers. Aye. Representative Edwards. Aye. Representative Corbin. Aye. Representative Torgner. Aye. Representative Hatter. Aye. Representative Starr. Aye. Representative Welch. Aye. Representative Williams. Excuse. Aye. And SGR
39 goes before the House with pass recommendation. Any volunteers for carrier?
Okay. Devlin? Okay. He's a hard-working guy.
He'd like to pay a lot of bills. And the work session is closed. And we will now open a public hearing on SB 1311. Mr. Cantine.
Chair, Senate Bill 1311 is the ballot measure itself. It's being referred by the legislature, and so the Senate Bill 13 was drafted to basically follow the language of Measure 30 and putting forth the question before the voter on whether to continue the requirements of reimbursing local governments for the cost of state mandates. If you look at that bill, basically the language in the summary and the language in the result of yes vote, result of no vote, are pretty much the same as they were in Measure 30 when it was presented to the voters for the first time, except now it's asking or saying that the yes vote would retain, and then the remainder of the caption is that state pay local government across the state mandated program. That's essentially what it was in the initial ballot measure. So it just does everything it can to just continue the language that was in the original ballot measure with adding the part about retaining or continuing.
Okay, questions from the committee? Anyone else in the audience want to testify on Senate Bill 1311? Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1311 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1311. Representative Starr.
Move Senate Bill 1311 before the recommendation.
Well, you've heard the motion to move the bill before the BPAS recommendations. Any discussion?
Chair.
Representative Beck.
I just want to make sure I understand this. If voters vote no on this measure, provisions of Measure 30 stay in place except for the fact that state would no longer have to pay local governments for state mandated programs. Is that correct? Or does it potentially repeal Measure 30? Or something?
Mr. Chair, if the voters would vote no, it would then invoke the sunset and it would repeal Measure 30. That's what would happen automatically.
Or if we don't refer this out,
yes.
And set.
Yes, that would be correct. However, I think the ballot measure itself requires that it be referred.
So what would be the ramifications of us not referring? We,
I get, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry, I missed some of the discussion.
If you failed to refer it, I would assume some interested party, certainly we would be interested, would some way go to whatever legal process we have to require that it be referred, because that was the language in the ballot measure itself. I don't think we had much of a choice. I don't know what else I can do.
Okay. Further questions or discussion? The motion floor, please call the roll.
Representative Beck.
Aye.
Representative Beck.
Aye.
Representative Byers.
Aye.
Representative Jones.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Carter.
Aye.
Representative Manning.
Excuse.
Representative Piercy.
Aye.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Representative Welch.
Aye.
Representative Williams?
Excuse.
Chair Sinner?
Aye. And any volunteers for carry on this bill? President Starr volunteers to carry the bill. And the bill goes before the House to be passed recommendation. Work session is closed. And we're going down the agenda.
Pardon me?
No, actually, Senate Bill 238, we are going to have to, all the amendments aren't ready for that. 2551 was finished. HR 17, we will hold off to another day for that. And it's posted up. We will now to, when we finished 117 yesterday, go to Senate Bill 404 now. And
sure. Mr. Chair, committee members, SB 404A. Before you have in your packet dash three amendments, they replace the original bill. That's why this bill is brought before you. It recognizes hunting game mammals and mammals not indigenous to state or region for most economic development. Establish a criteria for operating a hunting preserve and establish 1,500 acres as the minimum acres for hunting preserve.
Okay. And what we've got today is a litany of people to testify in opposition to this bill. And I will note, you see the A3 amendments before you there. We need to do a little bit of work on these amendments. We find line 20, pen needs to be defined. And there would be a little further work on the amendments before we go to any kind of a work session. But I will call Kelly Peterson and ask that that all of you who are here to testify, I guess we have ODSW here testifying without stating any kind of a position also, please come forward. The amendment just came out of LC today. It must have been circulated widely to the surface.
People standing at the door.
Okay.
I'm Kelly Peterson, and I'm here today to oppose Senate Bill 404, which does attempt to overturn the Fish and Wildlife Commission ban canned hunts. This bill has a very narrow definition of canned hunts and minimizes the ecological risk of exotic game ranch and canned hunt operations that do pose a native oppose a risk to our native wildlife, the public's wildlife. And I've had just 2 hours to look at the amendments, but it seems pretty impossible to enforce. The polling results from decision research even indicate that 73% of randomly selected Oregonians, hunters and non-hunters alike, support ban on canned hunts, which was defined in a questionnaire as an animal hunted within a fenced-in enclosure. Senate Bill 404 is an attempt to overturn a decision that would solely benefit one person, a person who has not operated in a fashion that merits special exemption. More importantly,
it's not. It would like to expand it to more operations in the state after Senate Bill 404.
That's actually been more problematic.
It's not just to protect Mr. Couch.
Well, actually, I've kind of read in the newspaper that that's kind of the intent, so I have like I said, I see it's for 2 hours.
Okay.
And it's definitely a little bit more broad than I had thought. But clearly right now there is one operation that does benefit. It economically benefits him, not the state of Oregon. I guess that's my point. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife had been working on this issue for almost 2 years. The adopted language was a result of discussions between hunting organizations, private citizens, and the Oregon State Police. Before adopting this administrative rule, the Fish and Wildlife Commission heard over 8 hours of testimony from private citizens within a 3-month period. We were given 3 weeks notice on these hearings, which was a little different than today. There were actually two brief hearings on House Bill 2554, a bill that would have banned canned hunts in its full form, and unfortunately, it allowed just for limited testimony. But during the last hearing of the Agriculture and Forestry Committee, the bill was tabled in anticipation of the Commission making its decision at its April meeting. The Fish and Wildlife Commission's decision involved months and months of citizen participation and public involvement. If this rule is overturned, there will be no incentive for future collaboration among private citizens and hunting and humane groups. Instead, initiatives will be the only clear way to demonstrate the mood of Oregonians. The Fish and Wildlife Commission, as you do know, voted unanimously to ban canned hunts without any exemptions for the following reasons. The owner of Clover Creek Ranch testified at the February Commission meeting to hunting three types of cervids within its fenced and enclosure, which does specifically violate Oregon's cervid rules. And I've attached the OARs along with Clark Couch's testimony. And this does clearly contradict Clark Couch's statements to the media that his business has been operating legally for the last 40 years. It's untrue, and it is a blatant attempt in disregard for our existing laws. Documented escapes have already happened from Clover Creek Ranch, including two escapes of elk. Exotic feral pigs have been found loose in Central Oregon. When exotics escape, they compete for food, and they do pose a health risk to our native wildlife, again, to our public wildlife. The same fences built to keep these exotics in keep our native wildlife out, which can be a significant loss of habitat to our native wildlife. And lastly, canned hunts or game ranch operations artificially confine hundreds of exotic species together, which does destroy the land. These animals are intentionally limited to the same acreage every day. These animals are not free, and they're not wild. It's also very easy to habituate confined animals to a point food source. Therefore, you know, regardless of the size of acreage, you know, it's still very easy to manipulate. I guess I'm asking you to respect and honor the long process the department and the citizens of Oregon have just completed. This rule was based on hours and hours of testimony and sound wildlife management. And I guess I'd ask you, why would you consider overturning a law that could lead to problems for our native wildlife? And again, that's the public's wildlife. I don't see that these risks are an economic benefit for Oregon or for Oregonians, and I don't believe in it, and I don't support it, and I'm asking you not to support the bill. Thank you.
Ms. Peterson, are you a hunter?
No, but I don't know how that's relevant really to this session. A canned hunt.
Have you ever tried hunting inside an enclosure?
My family hunts, if that qualifies me for even being credible on this topic. But have I ever hunted in the fenced enclosure? No, because I don't hunt.
Mr. Richard Byer.
Thank you. And Ms. Peterson, are you also opposed to the canned hunt sponsored by the state of Oregon every year?
Pardon? Could you explain it?
Sure,
I'm not like knowledgeable in every.
The State Department of Fish and Wildlife that they can hunt.
Oh, stuffy. Yes, I think that's unfair.
Okay. There are a lot of hunters who in the season go in and out of there unsuccessfully.
Well, there's like the population of hunters are such a minority of Oregonians. I guess I'm looking here at the poll. 73% of people are opposed to canned hunts. Just because people do it does not make it right.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Peterson, I agree with your position on the amendments to the bill, but I just wanted to have one word of caution, actually, also. The time that we are now in the legislative session, I would encourage vigilance, because at any time any bill with the right relating clause can change its nature within a very short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So in the following days, and about probably a few more days after this, you will see more lobbyists out here that don't really have bills that are up. They're just here to watch the relating clauses to see that somebody doesn't put something in there that might affect them adversely. So,
Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Where is this Clover Creek Ranch?
It's in Ashwood, Oregon.
And where's Ashwood again?
By Mathis.
Is it Rajneeshi country?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. No way. I think you made a statement, Mr. Chair, that this amendment actually is not to fix one problem. Are there more than one ranches that do this?
To my knowledge, in Oregon at this time, there aren't any.
but the, you know, economic development in rural Oregon is in a dire need, and I have been around operations that were hunting is conducted inside an enclosure, and I would defy you to take a bow into an 80-acre patch and find a black-tailed buck. I know that's disturbing, but you'd never be successful. You just wouldn't. And even though it meets the definition of canned hunt, if there's some opportunity to provide opportunity to economic development, rural, I think it's a tool that perhaps should be explored. So we have this bill before us today.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, Squire. I just want to point out to Representative Edwards that I don't see the property over near Ashwood and Antelope that would fit this definition, and where I do not now operate as a hunting preserve, the definition in this bill would allow that to happen, and I'm supportive of it because for the only reason I don't plan on doing that right now, but who knows? I mean, with the price of beef where it is, maybe someone wants to shoot my cow.
Beef and wheat and everything else. Let's get it back in.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question for whomever. I'm more comfortable asking because this is where I started the day this year, an hour ago. Mine's 8 and 9.
The deal?
Of the we have the word on there, mammal. And I'm wondering, honestly, it's curiosity. There's a lot of ranches too in eastern Oregon and southern Oregon will plant fowl, upland game birds and waterfowl. And I'm wondering if this bill, if you have any objection to that, which is not included in this bill, but if this bill in any way changes the effect of planting pheasants, which has been a long practice in eastern Oregon.
Hey, Lucier, I asked the representative from DFW when they get up here to ask a question.
I was just wanting to call us back to the issue that this is about dealing with non-indigenous animals, right?
Right, it is.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
Representative Byer.
On that note, sub 3 of section 3 concerns me somewhat on the draft and the things. I understand you didn't make some changes. The way I read that, if I have my cow tied and a mobile slaughter man comes in, it would then be breaking the law. Because a cow is not an indigenous animal to the state. And that cow is being tethered, tied, left hand.
Well, this is the first draft in this amendment, and you're exactly right. I was close. And we'll have to look at further refinements. So, any further questions or questions for Ms. Peterson? Thank you. Jeff Watson. Thank you for your patience. Yeah, it's been a long day.
Thank you. There is a little more clock watching. Thank you, Chair Simmons, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Watkins. I'm here today on behalf of the Sierra Club Oregon chapter and the Humane Society of the United States, and I have just three quick brief points. The first point is that we feel that the practice of canned hunt is unfortunate. I think you've heard some polling data, and I think most Oregonians, when they have a canned hunt described to them, that they have a sense that that's not really what they think of when they think of hunters going into the woods and trying to get an animal. The second point is that we share the concern with a lot of other parties, too, about bringing in exotic species into Oregon. Whenever you do that, there's a chance they can get out or unexpected things can happen. And I think if you're taking a risk, I think, endangering other wildlife or people's property or spreading disease by bringing in some exotic animals. The third point is that the Fish and Wildlife Commission has had a very deliberative process in examining this issue. They've had hearings, they've heard innumerable amounts of testimony from all types of Oregonians, including the owner of this ranch and people who might want to do it in the future, it's been just a very long, deliberative process, open process, and I think they made a good decision. They have a lot of information to make the decision about, and they made it, and I think we should support that decision.
Mr. Watkins, you're referring to the same poor information that's noted in Ms. Peterson's testimony?
Yeah.
I'd be interested in further information on that. Can you bring us more information, the questions, how they were asked and such?
I don't have that, but I'm sure someone could probably bring that to you, Ms. Peterson or someone.
Okay. I'd like to see the whole survey and the how things were framed. Further questions for Mr. Watkins? Ms. Starr?
Mr. Watkins, you mentioned canned hunt. That isn't, that this bill is not about canned hunt. Isn't this bill about hunting preserves?
Well, I guess it's all a matter of what words you use and what we think those words mean. I think what we're getting at is an enclosed area where the intent is to keep the animals in the enclosure. That would be my
matter. 50 acres or 5,000 acres? Or 5 acres?
I think so. That's the key thing, is that the enclosure is meant to keep the animals there. That's one of the main things that I believe is objectionable to most Oregonians. The other thing is that, through feeding or salt licks or other mechanisms, or it's easy to manipulate where the animals are kept. And so, but that's another component of it. So if you put those two things together, I think that's what's most objectionable.
To the chagrin of some of my colleagues, I joined with Representative Deckard in a bill that was discussed in the Ag Committee. And the reason I did that was the information that was provided to me about canned hunts. And unfortunately, this idea of a hunting preserve gets wrapped up into that same argument. And I believe they're two different animals, two different things. And the idea that we're shooting at animals that are tethered or tied or in an enclosed small areas is offensive to me. But an idea where you have a person that has a significant amount of land that his property, he decides to use it in such a way, I think that's a property right. Can you just comment on that?
I think that you're identifying something that's very true about the bill. There's degrees. And what's, obviously there's a difference between an animal that's tethered or tied or in a cage and shooting it versus if it's a 1,500 or 5-acre, 5,000 acre. There's a big difference. In terms of the property rights issues and things like that, we're dealing with wildlife, which I don't know about other states, but in Oregon, wildlife is a public resource. So even, if you have an elk on your property, it's not your elk, it's the people of Oregon's elk. And I think that's where I come on the side of that in terms of protecting Oregon's wildlife.
Listen, Byer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You represent the Sierra Club, the Humane Society, or you said a third group?
Sierra Club and Humane Society of the United States.
Okay. Is the Sierra Club and Humane Society also opposed to the state of Oregon's canned hunt?
I'm not sure. I'm just learning about the Starkey unit, is that what it's called? And the way it's described to me, it makes me uncomfortable. And I've actually talked to a couple of hunters about it, and they said that they're a little bit uncomfortable with that, too. So,
one more, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barr. You were saying that game animals, you ended up dealing with game animals, and those are property of the state, not people. This amendment is dealing specifically with non-indigenous mammals, so it is not dealing with game mammals. That's a comment. Another comment would be, I know a lot of hunters who, I travel with hunters every day, and I've never found one who is opposed to the state of Oregon canned hunt, and as the chairman said, many hunters have gone to that and come away unsuccessful.
Okay, I have a question for you, Mr. Watson. In thick cover, whitetail don't have a very large home range, maybe a couple of square miles. The bill requires
1,500 acres. That's more than 2 square miles. If you were hunting an animal outside the fence, outside of any fence, and he didn't on his own voluntarily leave a 2 square mile path, between that and if he was inside a fence?
Well, I guess your hypothetical is in whether there's a fence or not, sometimes you're not going to find him. I think that's your point. And that's where the sportsmanship of it comes in. I'm sure that happens on the Clover Ranch as well on occasion. But again, it's the combination of having enclosures where it's meant to confine the animal, even though it's a large example, and the ability to manipulate where the animals hang out. I think that those two things together are what proposes our objection.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have Dana Campbell. And Eileen Stark, are you together? We got to come up together. She's very indented. And if you have heard the testimony that's been offered previously,
yes,
if you want to kind of back that up, you can. Or if you have new information, bring that forward. As much as it's repetitive as stuff we've heard before, just you might mention that you support what we've already heard. So, go ahead. Introduce yourself for the record. And
sure. Let me start by saying my name is Dana Campbell. I'm a native Oregonian. I know we're rare. And I'm also a former deputy district attorney in Oregon. And I'm here as a staff attorney today for the Animal Legal Defense Fund, which is a nonprofit organization of members and also a network of 700 volunteer attorneys who work to improve and enforce laws that relate to the welfare of animals of all kinds. Eileen Stark is also here today. She's our education director. I have heard the testimony. I was at the Fish and Wildlife hearing where they decided to drop the grandfathering in clause for existing operations altogether and then vote unanimously to ban the canned hunt. And unfortunately, because of the rush in getting here and being able to appear today, I was not able to get some information that I thought would be very helpful to the members of the committee, but I would like to describe that for you now. And what that is a film report that was done by News Channel 8 approximately a week after the Fish and Wildlife Commission decided to invoke the ban against canned hunts. And it presented a perspective from both those of us that were in favor of the ban and also did some interviews with Mr. Clark Couch, who has the existing ranch operation. And the camera crews also went on to Mr. Couch's property and did some filming there while they were interviewing. And I think it'd be instructive for the committee members to see that because it was it showed a number of animals, I believe they were elk and other cervids, that were basically just standing around casually eating. They had no fear at all of the camera crew. They had no fear of the reporters there. They were pretty much just mingling with everybody out there doing the report. They continued their filming out along the outer edges of the enclosed area along the fences where they also showed animals backed up to those fences that appeared to have no fear of the camera crew and also nowhere else to go. It appeared not to be difficult for these camera crews to be able to find these exotic animals on the property. I don't know if that's because of the great quantity of them or because of their tameness with the humans on the property, but certainly it illustrated a point that was made earlier, that there are ways to manipulate these animals so that maybe their chase might not be involved because the animals are conditioned in such a way that they don't engage in chase anymore. They're not fearful of humans. And this bill, there's really no way to regulate that. This bill was put together in such a rush that, or appears to be,
But there's no way for Fish and Wildlife to monitor how these animals are and are not going to be conditioned on the property. There's no way to monitor even whether the animals once brought in, and however much of the quantity, because there's no regulation of that, how they will be cared for once on the property, whether they will have sufficient food or whether they will be conditioned. And these are obviously concerns of those of us that care about the wildlife of our state. If there's more work to be done on this bill, and I definitely think it needs work if it's going to continue at all, I think it would be instructive to be able to get a copy of that film to see for yourself what the conditions are on the ranch, as apparently investigated by a news crew there with no objective other than to report a story.
Mr. Barr. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you believe everything you see on TV?
I'm incapable of forming my own opinion. In my opinion, these animals weren't afraid of anybody that was there.
I guess my point would be that you saw a news clipping. You have no idea the background, where these animals came from, what the history behind them was, how many hours of newsreel film were shot in order to get these, I don't know, a few seconds probably, of an animal standing next to a fence.
That's correct. None of us do.
In the television depiction, did you identify a few of the animals that you saw?
I'm not very good at that myself. My husband was able to identify a number of them, including several kinds of cervids. And there may have been elk, but I cannot recall. This aired in April, and my memory is fuzzy. I'm not so good with identification, but yes, they were identifiable by the picture.
Could you provide us with a copy?
I'd like to try and see if I can get one. In the interest of time, I wasn't able to do it today, but I'd like to be able to follow up on that if I may.
We won't be moving this bill today.
Okay. Let me just wind up by saying that, as I outlined in my testimony, the bill as it is fails to take into account a number of critical factors that were raised at Fish and Wildlife, primarily that allowing the state to monitor and enforce these preserves or canned hunts to make sure that there aren't violations occurring. How will we know that these animals aren't being tied up? It's on private property. How do we know that they're not being conditioned to not be afraid of humans? And further, there's no funding in this bill to provide that kind of monitoring once we decide that's what we want to do, if that's what we decide we want to do. As mentioned by Ms. Peterson earlier, we don't know what quantities of these exotic animals are being brought in, how they're being cared for. We're not even sure how they're affecting the other native populations that they're being intermingled with on this property. And let me just correct in the statement that was made earlier that this bill does include native game mammals in addition to exotic animals. That's mentioned in line 12. There's no provisions here for penalties for people who don't comply with the requirements of this bill, that they not be tied, or that there's no provisions to apply for penalties for escapes if you're not maintaining your fences. There's no provisions providing penalties. There's no sunset provisions. There's no licensing requirements for people that are operating these ranches to determine that they're even qualified to care for these animals. In summary, it's very poorly framed. Amendment, and we oppose it at the Animal Legal Defense Fund. We ask the committee members to do the same.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Eileen Stark, and most of what I wanted to say has already been said today, so I just want to reiterate that I also support what's been said. I did want to address briefly line number 16. Talks about that the hunt must include the element of fair chase, but I feel that no matter the size of the enclosure, there will always be a fence, there will always be a wall, there will always be some sort of barrier. Hunting intentionally confined animals in human-made enclosures clearly is not ethical hunting. In the book Beyond Fair Chase, written by a top official with the Montana Department of Fish and Wildlife, fair chase is described as hunting free-ranging wild animals. And we see this as a public issue, and although animals are currently seen as property under the law, wildlife should not just belong to a small percentage of people who hunt this way. In 1977, legislators decided that the ODFW Commission, whose mission it is to protect Oregon's wildlife, should be the ones to determine whether canned hunt facilities should exist or not. So we urge you to stand by the commission and respect their decision. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Clark? Thank you, ladies, for coming to your patience. It's been a long afternoon. Meg Miller. And would Susan Mentley care to come at the same time? Okay. See, you've heard the drill previous. If you have new information, please bring it forward.
Good afternoon, Chair Simmons, committee members. My name is Meg Miller, and I am here as the Outreach Coordinator for In Defense of Animals, the National Animal Advocacy Organization, and we have an office in Portland. And I'm here to ask you not to support SB 404. Our organization was involved with the Fish and Wildlife Commission meetings and hearings regarding the same issue. And I feel very strongly that we should support the decision of Fish and Wildlife Commission. And I guess I'm wondering why all of a sudden there's been this interest from our legislature on this issue. I know before we tried to, that a bill was introduced that would have banned canned hunt in Oregon, and there were several hearings Kelly Peterson talked about, and the bill, my understanding that bill was tabled, and after ODFMW or Fish and Wildlife Commission made their decision, it seems as though this bill has kind of popped up after that, and I'm concerned as to why that's happened. And the other thing that I think is important, I've included a copy of the Clover Creek Ranch brochure. I think it's from 1996, so it is slightly outdated, but it lists the animals that Mr. Couch has on his ranch, and according to current laws, around half of the animals on his ranch he can still hunt them, or people can still come and hunt. So I think it's important for committee members to know that we're not putting him out of business. This is just affecting certain animals on his ranch, some which are cervids, which are already illegal to hunt. So I ask you not to support SB 404.
Good afternoon, and my name is Susan Mentley. I'm representing the Oregon Humane Society, and for the sake of brevity, I do know that it's party time. I just want to reiterate what a couple of the other folks have said. I've attended the two commission meetings in Portland and the one in Pendleton, and I know that you're getting pretty much the constituency from the Valley and, you know, the animal rights or the animal welfare or the animal interest groups. In Pendleton, there was a very mixed amount of folks over there testifying, both for and against, but there were a good number of hunters. And it was my perception that the commission was really struggling at that time. They were I do believe that night they were inclined to vote for the grandfathering, but they ran out of time and had to fly back to Portland. And at the next meeting in Portland, they were still struggling. But at that meeting, there was such compelling testimony from not necessarily the folks that you're seeing here tonight, but from folks from Eastern Oregon that do hunt and that were familiar with Clover Creek Ranch, the operators and the operations. And based on the testimony from that meeting in Portland, the ultimate vote was a unanimous no to grandfathering. So, you know, it really was the testimony. It was compelling. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about cervids and some of the exotics. And it was because we sat there for 2 or 3 hours on Friday afternoons and listened to this, and that's how the commission ended up voting. And I just wanted to mention that you've got some pretty compelling testimony in writing from some of the same folks that testified in Portland. I would strongly urge you to read this, because I know that you're getting sort of the one line from the folks in Portland, and I know that that's an issue, you know, because obviously we're not hunters, but there are hunters that did testify.
I've worked as a hunting guide, both in Oregon and New Mexico and in Argentina, and have been inside a fence. And it was a struggle.
to see the hunter, I had bagging any game. It was a major struggle.
Sure. Chair Simmons, that was some of the testimony, yes. But there also was a considerable amount of testimony from folks that said that this was a good opportunity for handicapped, for overweight hunters, and for children to shoot animals. So I guess I would question how it could be an opportunity for folks that obviously had impairments and then also be a fair chase.
Mm-hmm. And some of the nexus for this is background for you. This is brought at the request of Representative Ben Westland,
mm-hmm.
and who represents the area where Mr. Couch's ranch here. And it's viewed by a number of members of the legislature, and myself included, as an infringement on a basic property right. That he should have the right to proceed and operate with his facility, and including the service. I feel quite strongly about that. I'd be open to discussion of amendments and how we might craft this and working with you.
Yes, well, I'd like to ask you, people giving testimony, is your group that you represent, do they oppose hunting of any kind?
Chair Simmons, Representative Welsh, no.
What type of, just this type of hunting do you oppose?
Chair Simmons, Representative Welsh, the canned hunting concept is one that does seem unfair, and I do know that the polls reflect that the majority of Oregonians feel the same way.
Chair Simmons and Representative Welsh, in defense of animals, does oppose all forms of hunting.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Yes, sir. Well,
do you oppose the use of guns in hunting?
I would think so, yes.
So you oppose using, Mr. Chair, oppose using bow and arrow?
Like I said, we oppose all forms of hunting, so that would include any weapon, I would think.
Mr. Chair, I found that a lot of those proponents for animal rights to oppose. And when we found hunting and use of guns or bow and arrows, and we found in 1995 in the Cougar Bill that that's really what they were going after. Those guns and bows and arrows. They oppose hunting.
I decide my comment would be, as a non-hunter myself, that I don't think that that means that I can't have an opinion or a system of belief about what would constitute fair hunting, just as if you don't teach school but you have opinions about what goes on in the classroom. And we all are entitled to look at things from our perspective and try to weigh what's right and wrong for those things. We have to respect non-hunters' views of this as well as hunters' views of it, like with all the other things we do in our society.
Thank you very much, Mr. Senator. Mr. Devler?
Mr. Chairman, I don't want to continue too much longer, but I would point out that even though all the parties that have spoken here have been opponents of the amendment, there is still a range of opinions on the issues that are being presented. I don't think all of the parties would say that they, one of them is clearly says that they're not opposed to hunting, and one has said that they are. And so that there's a broad range of feelings here, and I'm assuming, you know, that if there are other groups here, you have an even broader range. So,
I'm doing some
well. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll call now Al Elkin. Mr. Elkins, how are you today?
Hi, thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Al Elkins. I'm the representing the Oregon Hunters Association. And in our at our May meeting, the Oregon Hunters Association had last month in Bend, the board voted to uphold and support the recommendation that the ODFW Commission made on canned hunts. They did so after hearing testimony by the state president, Sandy Sanderson, who was at all the ODFW Commission meetings in relation to this issue.
He could not be here this evening. He's in at graduation in California with one of his granddaughters, but asked me to speak for the association. We believe that this amendment consequently is in conflict with the ruling that the ODFW Commission made, and that's why we're that's why we're not in support of the amendment as written. And that's what I have to say.
President Barr, just like to point out for the record, as a member of the Oregon Hunters Association, I'm going to say that the association is not speaking for me in this case.
I understand that.
Thank you, President Barr. President Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Elkin, does the Hunting Association make any differentiate at all between hunting with an animal that's feathered or in a pen or in an enclosed area, as opposed to hunting in a game reserve that's several hundred acres?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Starr, we have never, we discussed the issue when we looked at the original canned hunt bill, and we did not like the words tethered and caged, and we were opposed to any hunting that involved those three things. We have never gotten into distances or enclosures or anything of that nature in terms of our discussions. Our only discussion was around the commission's ruling and our support for it, but we did not get into particular discussions about any distances or things of that nature.
Yes, Mr. Clark.
In the Hunting Association's decision and Representative Byers' comment here, did they ask hunters around the state before they made the decision?
During that, Mr. Chair, Representative Starr, during that whole situation with the commission, we got a lot of phone calls. The board did in relation to the issue, and they felt like they were voting for what they had heard from the members that they represented at that time. The board set up so that the directors from the different regions sit on the board, so they felt that was who they represented.
President Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't going to go this way, but I'm happy to know. Al, I know you don't go to the magazine, don't edit the magazine, but just about a month before the decision came out in the May meeting, a very nice, very well-written article appeared in the Oregon Hunters magazine featuring the Clark Culver Ranch, and at that time it was very clearly stated that this ranch was not considered by the Oregon Hunters Association as a canned hunt, and it was a very sporting event to go there, and I find it very interesting now that they would flip-flop.
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, I have not read the article. It's been referred to, and I'm at fault for not reading it. The board studied the issue hard and believed that ODFW and their decision had all the hours of testimony, and they manage wildlife, and they know what's good for wildlife, we felt, and that's where the board came down on supporting their decision. And those are some of the things that they talked about, what I talked to Representative Starr about and others, are some of the things they talked about in relation to making that decision.
Thank you. Did you, in your deliberation, did you discuss the private property rights aspect of the ruling by the department?
No, sir. We did not. In relation to the ruling of the department, we did not talk about private property rights. Just about management of wildlife.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Berry and Mr. Edwards. I know it's been a long afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you so much. You've probably been here since 3 o'clock. We were scheduled to start, and we were also on the floor of the House, and I appreciate your indulgence and your patience.
Thank you, Chair Simmons. For the record, my name is Rich Berry with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I'm the Wildlife Division Director. With me, I have Dan Edwards. Dan is the Big Game Program Director. I would like to make a few comments on the proposed amendment, like others who saw the proposed amendment this afternoon. Mainly, what I would just like to raise is just some concerns that we have, and some of it has been clarity, I guess, and just potentially the sponsors of the bill may be able to clarify some of the things that we see in there. The words that are used here are hunting preserve. In statute, that wording is only used in one other place in statute within the state of Oregon, and that refers to a hunting preserve for game birds. And within that regulation, the legislature laid out various restrictions, etc., the authority of the commission to regulate, the licenses required, all these types of things. What is unclear to me and to our staff as we've read this, and because we do deal with all the regulations and statutes, is essentially what is the commission's authority within the hunting preserve, or what is the legislative intent for the commission to do such things within hunting preserves. In our reading of this, we do read that it says game mammals is one type of animals, and that by statute is deer, elk, bear, cougar, mountain goat, mountain sheep, and silver gray squirrel, that by statute. Then it talks about mammals not indigenous to the state. That essentially can be anything, elephants, bears, or elephants, lions, tigers, whatever.
Grizzly bear.
Right. It could be anything. Now, we do have, as we talk about mammals not indigenous to the state, the commission does, in fact, have rules that regulate animals that may come into the state that could affect native wildlife, adversely affect native wildlife, and this passed a number of regulations that prohibit some animals, that regulate some animals, and some animals saying we see no impact should they escape. So those are kind of generally some of what our concerns within this is that we're not sure if this is essentially, if I'm a landowner and I have 1,500 acres, I declare I have a hunting preserve and I can hunt anytime, anywhere, any species, bring in any species, not have to have fences, not have to have whatever the scenario. And those are kind of the questions that have raised our concern that it's not necessarily following what we see in statute for the game bird regulations, where it has talked specifically to those types of authority for the commission. And so those are just kind of the questions that we have asked. And again, we just saw this this afternoon. We have a couple of questions. Fair chase, what is the definition of fair chase? That's through testimony that you heard today and for testimony that was brought before the House Committee on House Bill 2564. That was a great debate. That is a lot of means to different people. Again, we question whether this means, for example, when we have free-ranging wildlife in the state, the state's wildlife that we say belong to everybody, should they be on, quote, a hunting preserve, so they now become whoever land they may be on at that point in time. Just those types of things are what raise red flags to us that we're just not certain maybe what the intent of the sponsors may be, and hopefully somewhere along the lines that would clarify that should this bill move forward so that our commission would know exactly what they ought to do from this, if they are to pass regulations, et cetera, or whether the legislature is essentially saying they have no authority within this area. Certainly we believe as managers of our commission has authority under the wildlife laws to do certain things for wildlife, but this kind of leaves some unanswered questions. We would be glad to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, I appreciate that. I appreciate your input here, and as far as definition, I've made a few notes on the amendment here. I think we needed to define 10 also on lines 20 and line 23, and your amendment could use some work. Okay. Thank you very much. Question, Barr?
Hey, Mr. Chair. Do you, either one of you consider, or both of you consider, it ethical to hunt by being tied, tethered, or penned?
I would consider it unethical.
I would agree.
Although, you need your name.
What's that?
Your name?
For the record, my name is Dan Edwards, Game Program Manager.
Okay. Now we have that on the record. You both consider it ethical to abuse the system put in place by the Department of Fish and Wildlife in order to gain points to in official hunting capacity?
Representative Byerson, Senator Representative Byerson, that involved me directly. I believe I made a mistake in judgment there. I think it was neither illegal or unethical through the finding of the director's investigation, but I do believe it was an error in judgment to put myself on an equal plane with the public through the opportunity they had. But I need to hold myself at a higher level than that, and I apologize to everyone in the state, including the legislature, for that indiscretion. But I do believe that the type of hunting described here is not the best thing for Oregon's wildlife, nor hunting into the future. I think hunting is going to come under grave challenges by some of the folks that you probably heard testimony from here today who oppose all kinds of hunting, and this type of hunting is going to be a black mark there, I believe.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Did I hear you correctly say you don't feel what you did was unethical to use insider information to gain advantages over the general public in order to obtain big gain things? You don't feel that was unethical?
Chair Simmons, Representative Byers, I don't want to argue over the term ethics. I believe I made an error in judgment to do what I did, and I'll leave it at that. It was an error in judgment, and I apologize to everyone for that. It was poor decision-making.
Now, Mr. Chair, I find it very ironic that the same people are saying it's unethical to hunt private property to shoot it any way you so well choose in an area, an element of fair chase. The same people who should have been much more severely reprimanded than what they were, in my opinion, think it's unethical to do one thing, yet when they use insider information to gain advantage of the general public, that's not considered unethical. I find that the utmost in hypocrisy.
Mr. Chair.
Mrs. Welch.
Does the department, are they mostly concerned about in this bill involvement of exotic non-indigenous animals, the biggest issue?
Chair Simmons, Representative Edwards, the commission in their action, there are existing administrative rules that prohibit the holding of cervids, elk, deer, and the hunting of cervids, elk, deer. There are administrative rules that prohibit the possession of animals that have been classified as controlled, the ones we would have concern over within the state. Mr. Couch's his allegations is not out of business. The film that was referred to on Channel 8, the animals that we saw there are legal for him to have. At least there may have been, it was a picture of a deer or an elk, and we're not sure where that picture was taken from. But he has, in fact, he testified himself that he had animals that are, in fact, illegal for individuals to be holding in the state. No other individual in the state is allowed to hold them, and he is holding some of them, indicating he had hunted some of them. I think the commission has, just in general, not just the exotics, they have both the game mammals and the hunting and privately held hunting of game mammals, where they have also passed rules prohibiting that.
Mrs.
Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When the commission banned canines, it did not put a grandfather clause in it. Most times when you ban something, you must have defined it. Could you provide me later with what the commission's ruling was on what the definition of canine hunts was?
Chair Simmons, Representative Devlin, what we can do is provide you with a handout, or actually right now, in that was where we presented to the commission the grandfathering clause. The commission did not ban canine hunt as used by that term. What they banned was the hunting of game mammals or exotics privately held. And so,
Privately held.
For example, again, they already had statutes on this that if you are a cervid rancher, which there are some 15 of in the state, they can rear those animals, et cetera, but they cannot hunt them. There are people who can also hold animals that are designed or designated to be exotic. They could not hunt those. Such things as Mr. Couch says is a lot of the sheep that we saw, a lot of the swine that we saw are considered to be domestic. By definition, we do not control those, and he is free to hunt those animals, and that's, again, from the film we saw, that would appear to be most of the animals that he had. But we also did see some, or testimony was given by himself and by others, that there had been some deer taken, and that there had been some elk taken, again, which no other individual in the state of Oregon is allowed to do.
Mr. Chairman, a follow-up.
Mr. Devlin.
I understand some of my colleagues' concerns here. The issue of private property rights, I might disagree with. They may have different interpretations. But going to one of these issues about fair chase and the basic issue that appears to be represented in the public is the issue of fairness in general. Going away from the issue of the size of a facility or even if there's restrictions in movement in the facility in terms of fences, because there are probably fences next to
areas that are on public land also. But if you take the species and you take it outside its normal environment, some of those species might be as far as if you take some of the non-indigenous, and you actually have examples of maybe bringing a tiger here. Obviously, a tiger is a carnivorous animal. If you don't have something on the site for it to hunt, you're going to have to provide it with food. Some other animals are not carnivorous. If they don't have the habitat that they would normally have, you might still have to supplement the diet. Once you start doing those things, don't you actually change the very nature of the situation under which they would be hunted?
Representative Devlin, undoubtedly. Mr. Couch himself testified, and actually from the pictures that were shown, he has pens where the animals are reared, and he breeds animals, but they also have feeding stations throughout the compound, those types of things. So, yes, you potentially are changing how an animal may behave. A true wild animal may behave as someone who said some type of domestic rearing associated with it.
Mr. Chairman, I have an interesting situation which I've never explained to you. My largest or most significant, and I still don't know the way he wants me to vote, opponent as a ban on bearing cougar skins is a brother. He's adamantly opposed to the ban on bear and cougar hunting, but he's also adamantly opposed to what he refers to as canned hunt. So there's a variety of opinions.
Mm-hmm. I did look through some of the information provided by Kelly Peterson, our first witness here, and it noted the ORSs that were attached for testimony where it indicates you can keep these cervids for meat purposes, but not to hunt. And for fallow deer or axis deer, what led you to make that decision?
I'll let Mr. Edwards answer that. He was involved in the commission for that.
Oh, Chair Simmons, the Fish and Wildlife Commission went through quite a lengthy process in the summer of 1992 and 1993. And finally, in January of 1993, they adopted Division 49 of the administrative rules, which deals with the propagation and holding of cervids, which are members of the deer and elk family. There was a huge amount of testimony, experts brought in from all over the nation, both proponents and opponents to the cervid ranching industry primarily. Some of the main issues that were brought about out of that were related to commercialization of wildlife, disease, competition with native species, should these animals escape, and so there was a large number of issues there, genetic pollution of native elk by mixing with red deer, which is the same species but quite a morphologically different beast from Europe. And so the Fish and Wildlife Commission weighed many of these issues and came to the determination that this was the raising of cervids unrestricted was not in the best interest of Oregon's wildlife from the standpoint of these various things. Now, with reindeer and fallow deer, these were two species that still carried some concerns about disease, but they did not carry the concerns about any...
Fangs?
That's one of the ones. They would still be capable of carrying most of the diseases that an elk would, for example, or other things. So the disease issue was still there with reindeer and fallow deer. But interbreeding was not... some of the other issues, and so the commission looked at this and they wanted to allow the industry to grow at some level, but not at all levels, and they felt reindeer and fallow deer were the two species that posed the least threat to native wildlife, and so those were the animals that you or I, if we built the proper facility, could obtain a license to have and start an operation and have. Other species of the family cervidae they saw as a greater threat, and they grandfathered in people who were in operation at that time with what's called a cervid holding permit, but then said that after a certain date that they would not allow any more. Now, recently they've adopted a new rule to allow 5 additional elk permits. They also, sometime after the original rules were adopted, allowed the sale of psychedeer meat, but they would allow the sale of psychedeer meat, fallow deer, reindeer meat. and they felt that those types of meat were identifiable from native meat easily and should not cause impact to commercialization of wildlife, but potentially allowing elk meat or something of that nature.
For filtering into the market and people poaching and then bringing it in.
Kirsten, can I also add, Mr. Couch has on several occasions challenged a number of these rules, COVID rules and so on, and the courts have upheld the department's authority to regulate and the various rules that they have adopted. So we've gone all the way to the Oregon Supreme Court with this issue, and private property rights was one of the issues raised during the process.
All right, any questions? Little questions from the committee? Those of those who are left, diehards here. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to sell an apple pie for me. Render it on private property in the effect.
Yep, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 404 and some other business before the committee. Pardon me? You are adjourned.